Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Well, I think the gas cylinder in my chair is going through its last dying gasps. And if you hear a kind of a crunching sound, and I sound really funny because the microphone's up my nose, well, that's what's going on. So it is a crazy, as always, another actual day of Action Radio. We really don't going to have, I don't know if folks understand how much of this show is in. I have my line, and I've got, we all sort of, you know, at least get topic a lot. And I'm going to wing it. I think it's much more fun that way. So you never really know what's going to happen. That's what the guess. I don't go over questions. We don't do any of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, when I say that my gas cylinder could crunch at any time, I'm not kidding. And that's going to be for a very interesting show. Again, if I'm talking about, you know, my forehead, so it could happen, in which case I'll have to rely on Gene to take over. That I quickly have to be used. So that's where we're going. There's a lot. It's like this endless tragedy in comedy that's completely preventable. The tragedy in some way are tractable. In fact, almost everything is preventable. Filling the White House by the Democrat Marxist was preventable. You look at the chain we're going to talk about in a bit. The title of the show is preventable. The energy that we don't have, we used to have, you know, before the White House was stolen, is preventable. The people that are going to freeze to death this winter because everything is too expensive, you know, natural gas, electricity, all these things, energy, you know, have been blocked that are on federal land. That's preventable. Federal land, even having the federal government have federal land, that's preventable too. They don't even have there's no reason for them to have federal land. And so one of our big projects here, one of my long term, is that it's all federal land back to states wherein they reside. And that is 5 states, like 70% federalized. Well, the federal government, the Constitution, allowing the federal government to own land, and various border facilities and military bases, you know, the land under military bases, is allowed to be federalized. And that's pretty much it. So all these vast reserves in the states, especially energy resources, timber, you know, land, none of that is legal. So it doesn't, you know, look at whatever's going on today that wasn't going on a year ago. Well, the reason it wasn't going on, well, I said, let's make it 2 years ago, because COVID was an artificial government policy never should have gone along with. But the point is that we were in a situation 2 years ago where things were going right. And I want you to think back and remember how many things were going right. Life was easy. You had jobs. People actually went to them because they weren't being paid to not go. And you look at everything that's happened since the government decided on our government. You know, the people didn't decide the last election. The government did. And so when the government puts the government in charge, things always go wrong because they try to centrally plan everything, and they can't. They can't take into account all the variables of the decisions you would make as an individual. And the collective effect of individual decisions is what determines the market, the price, the supply, the availability, you know, which goods make it and which ones don't. All that stuff is determined by the collective effect of individual decisions nationwide. And we don't have that now. We have a government trying to manage everything according to their ideology, and is failing miserably. So let's bring Gene into the conversation, and news that you have, things you've been thinking, observations, you know, since our last show, and or anything else. What's going on? It's getting colder up where you are, so that's a consideration. Energy is a huge consideration for your folks. Are you hearing anything up there, people?
You know, at this point, you know, they may talk about it a little bit, but I wouldn't say they're really concerned. Not right now. I think they're just, you know, they're just doing the day by, you know, they're just doing the day by day thing. It's like getting, you know, not looking so far into the future, which is sad, because you really do have to, considering how gas prices continue to rise, and we're not even in the coldest part of the year, and a lot of people use electric not electric, gas, some type, to heat their house. Yes, which I think is very scary. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's it.
Okay. See, I'm not familiar with gas heating. That to me is unusual. I'm not used to that. I remember oil heat, because when I lived in California, we really didn't have to worry about it.
Well,
it got a little bit cold,
yeah,
but, you know, a space heater, and you're fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, but the thing with the space heater, when it's like 20, 30 below zero, you know, a space heater's not going to do a whole lot of good to heat your home.
Well, anything below freezing.
You know,
it doesn't work because you need. Go ahead.
If you have to go out to work, I would never leave a space heater on when you're not there. That's always scares me, because a whole lot of fires start, and especially if you have pets or something, if it, you know, can knock it over, and it's just interesting.
Well, there's space heaters and space heaters. The space heaters used to be really dangerous because they're basically these open electric elements with a reflector behind them. And they would heat up the area right in front of them and nothing around them. And so in California, where it's when we had winter in San Francisco and in the San Francisco Bay Area, winter was, you know, maybe it got down to somewhere in the high 30s. It really never got below freezing. It did, you know, once you cross the East Bay Hills, we'd plenty get below freezing there. But and a lot of places, you know, a lot of homes had central heat, but they didn't need it very much. You know, so for California, the Bay Area, it's a pretty decent situation. But if you're in a place that gets below freezing, below 32 degrees, where the pipes freeze and then they burst because water, as water turns to ice, it expands more. And that's what breaks the pipes apart, and it stops flowing. You need central heat on all the time to a certain extent. Now, you can turn it down when you go to work. You know, if nobody's home, you know, the kids are at school, everybody else is at work, the house is empty. Sure, you can turn it down to, you know, 50 degrees, and who cares? You know, turn it back up to 70 when you get home, or 68 or whatever you keep it at. But the space heater only works when you're in the room. You know, near it, so if anything happens, you can stop it immediately. And of course, it's always good to have a fire extinguisher, you know, handy in your house anyway. But the little heaters that now available now are much safer, you know, much easier to use. But they're not designed to heat a house; they're designed to sort of warm an area in front of them temporarily, like at night. You know, Florida, same thing here. I'm in the Panhandle, and it'll get cold enough at night, you know, in the wintertime, that a little space heat, you know, makes a huge difference. But you don't need central heating. You know, and for the pipes, you just leave the water running a little bit, you know, so they don't freeze. And that works fine. So there's different things. But up north, whew, it's going to be a brutal winter in terms of cost. You know, if you have gas lines or if you have oil supply problems, you know, considering the pipeline. Well, how close are you to the pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, now that I think about it? I'm just curious. Is it running right through Minnesota?
I don't think so. I know they're in towards North Dakota and stuff, but the bottom line is this: doesn't matter. And the reason I say that it matters where you get your whatever gas, oil, whatever from. And the reason I say that, I had a friend, he unfortunately died a few years ago, but he was in the gas business in West Virginia, and what they brought in through their service, none of it was used in West Virginia. It was all trucked out. Which makes no sense, but that's how they do it. So someone that has gas coming in one part may have to ship it somewhere else. They can't even use it locally, or don't use it locally for whatever reason. I forget what it was, but yeah. So that's a big thing. And
I remember the pipeline, Keystone Pipeline, actually went to Texas, and the oil was refined down there. But their pipelines all over this country, don't they pipe it? I'm surprised they wouldn't pipe it back up. You know, and back across, you know, pipelines are better than trucks. They're much safer. You know, much more oil, petroleum can be transferred. You look at refineries have pipelines to local gas stations over 50, 100 miles away, you know, especially in the big cities. It's all pipelines, not trucks. Trucks would be too inefficient. They wouldn't get the fuel. There isn't enough truck capacity to keep gas stations going in major cities. You know, that's why they have pipelines. Huh. You were going to say something.
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly where it comes from or anything like that. That I don't know.
Okay, interesting. Well, I know it's Canada. As I think about it, it's Canada to Texas, and then Texas out from there. So I got a bunch of interesting stuff here for notes and things and interesting events. We've got Cindy Cagle coming up at 6:30, and with one of our medical freedom reports. But there's something I found. I've been looking for a decent article. That's why I haven't reported on the supply chain problems. I was looking for a really decent article, and I found one. And I found this one courtesy of One American News, who reported on this same person, actually had him on the show. And so it's nice to get those, but it's also nice that I can do more detailed than they can, because they're TV and, you know, they think that, you know, 2 minutes, that's a major news report. Anyway, so this is in the Daily Signal. It's Peter S. Ong or Ange. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. It's O-N-G-E. So Peter Saint Ange. Saint, you know, O-N-G-E. It's October 15th. He wrote this Daily Signal. And so he's economic research fellow at the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies. And it's part of the Heritage Foundation. Now you've noticed I haven't said a lot of good things about the Heritage Foundation. I think they're a bunch of, elite, you know, folks that think they're the elite of the conservative movement, and they spend most of their money on luncheons. And if you've ever been to, we can ask Mosley about that, a luncheon at the Heritage Foundation. You know, they spend more money. You know, if I could have their luncheon budget, Action Radio would be a household word, but that's another story. All right. He says, having made a mess in Afghanistan, the Biden insurrection, that's my word, Biden insurrection now turns its trademark incompetence to something closer to home, namely the supply chains that put toys under our Christmas trees and food on our tables. And of course, that's where I got the idea for the title of the show today, which is The Government Grinch is Stealing Christmas. Biden is using the pandemic as an excuse, but the truth is that government diktats, that's D-I-K-T-A-T-S, diktats, handouts, and cronyism have catastrophically gummed up our supply chains, and it's getting worse. In response to rising criticism about his absent administration amid bare shelves, Biden trending online, the insurrectionist himself, he says the president, but I'll just say, you know, President Nobody bestirred himself to trumpet a Band-Aid while his transportation secretary smirks about late shoppers and predicts shortages may last years and years. And the thing about this is all preventable. None of this was going on 2 years ago. Okay. Did the economy radically change? Did something radically change? Did we suddenly lose oil? Did, the worldwide energy situation change or anything else? No, the only thing that changed was the government stole the government. Kind of like that line, the government stole the government. It's kind of interesting when you think about it. But that's what happened. So the government's imposing everything that they want, which is nothing that we want, which is why they had to steal the government. They knew they had to steal the government because they knew we would never vote for the government stealing the government and doing what they're doing to us now. There's no way this would pass. If they ever ran on this and said, yeah, we want to disrupt the supply chain, we want to take your food away, we want to raise the price of everything, we want to curtail energy, we want to pay, you know, millions of people not to work, we want to lock down, mask, and you know, give everybody an obsolete vaccine for an alpha variant that died out a year ago, and mandate that for you know, something that's non-existent today, nobody would vote for that. Nobody. And that's why I call him President Nobody, because nobody would vote for this. All right. I kind of like that line, too. I'm on a roll today. This is kind of fun. Back to the article. Contrast this fatalism with former President Donald Trump's hyperactivity when supply chains were creaking early in the COVID-19 pandemic. Sitting down with the people doing the actual work, asking them what's in the way, what they need, and what's gumming things up, and then jawboning and executive ordering bureaucrats to get off their rears. Charitable with the bureaucrats. He says, instead, the Biden insurrection mumbles and smirks while in the shadows handing over supply chains to unions and environmental activists. Supply chains are in trouble worldwide due to Chinese disruptions, and the U.S. stands out by far, particularly in the port of Los Angeles, which, together with the adjacent port of Long Beach, handles, are you ready for this, 40% of containers, bringing both finished goods to American homes and critical parts and materials to American factories. They call it just-in-time production. And so whereas there were days when warehouses used to keep all kinds of parts and they would, you know, ship them in, that got expensive. So with computer technology, they have what they call just-in-time. In other words, the parts arrive at the factory each day just in time for production. Okay, and that's more efficient. But you can see how easy it is to disrupt a just-in-time, you know, to not just-in-time. And that's what we have now. So the factory parts are not just-in-time. And so they're not there, so they're not going into the trucks. The computer chips, everything else that needs to be made for these things is not just in time anymore. In fact, it's not in time at all. Back to the article. Without these containers, entire industries grind to a halt and shelves clear across America. There are now 50 to 70 ships anchored off Los Angeles with delays up to 3 weeks. Los Angeles overflow now clogs ports across the country. For those that know anything about air travel, there's something called flow control. And I'm guessing this happens with ships as well. So flow control is where the air traffic control system is coordinated such that you don't take off from Los Angeles flying to New York unless there's a landing spot for you in New York. In other words, the computer has already allocated you a window of time to land. And if anything backs that up, if they have weather delays, if they have whatever's going on, usually weather delays, they don't let you take off. Okay, so that's why I have delays on takeoff. It's not that they're trying to hold you there, you know, for no reason. It's that they don't want to take off and sit there and fly circles over New York waiting for a place to land. That's how they used to do it back in the 60s when fuel was cheap. They had what they call holding patterns. And these airliners would sit above, and they'd circle and circle, and then they'd come down 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet, and they'd circle and circle, and they kind of work their way down. If you ever remember the movie, one of the airport films, you know, Rack 'em, Stack 'em, or whatever else it was. Or maybe it was the Bruce Willis Die Hard films. Anyway, whatever it was, they don't do that anymore because they don't have to. So you don't take off until you have a space to land. Same thing with ships. You know, they need a place to land. They need a place to dock. And I imagine that they control this well enough that they don't send ships out, you know, until they have a space to go, unless something like this happens, in which case they sit there. But once these ships go away, they're not going to come back until they have a place to land. And so that's going to hold things up too, because then they have to cross the ocean and find their dock. So flow control, you know, I believe it's going to work across the whole country. Trucks, same thing. Well, you're not going to schedule a factory to build things if you don't have your parts, because the trucks aren't being scheduled to go pick it up because the container's not there. So the disruptions are across the entire supply chain. And none of this happened under Trump. Why? Because Trump made sure that the trucks kept moving, people kept working, the economy kept going, money kept coming in, tariffs were imposed on the people that were cheating unfairly with us, and the system worked under Trump. Why? Because he knew what he was doing. You know, he wasn't he had America working for America instead of what we have now, which is the government wants to work, everybody would work for the government. It just doesn't work that way. Gene, do you have a comment here as I'm going along? Like I say, feel free to ping the hotel bell if something inspires you as I'm going through this. But this is a very comprehensive story, and I'll get back to it in just a bit, and, you know, until Cindy gets here, and then I'll pick it up after that as well. But comments so far?
No, I don't have any comments so far.
Okay. I think you cut out for just a second there. So, you know, the usual problems are too many windows open, which is a problem I have. If I'm cutting out too, let me know too, because I have a bunch of windows open for today's show.
Yeah, my computer's been acting weird all day.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, one of the problems is it usually cuts out on whatever the most critical word is that you're going to say. That's where it's going to cut out. So if people hear me repeating things, the reason is I got a much better chance of one of them, just in case, you know, I lose a word, which will happen. You know, I get a better chance of getting it the second time. All right, so let's go back to our fascinating article. So this is just to back up a second. Without those containers, entire industries grind to a halt and shelves clear across America. There are now 50 to 70 ships anchored off Los Angeles with delays of up to 3 weeks. Los Angeles overflow now clogs ports across the country. Roughly 16% of all trans-Pacific ships are currently stuck at anchor, while government-owned and unionized Port of Los Angeles strolls along at 60 to 70% capacity, closed evenings and Sundays. Now, I know Governor DeSantis here in Florida said, well, bring your ships here. Well, it's not that easy to do, because I don't think most of these ships can even make it to the Panama Canal, which means sailing around South America, around Cape Horn, to get here. And I don't think they're going to do that either. So they're going to sit there. That's why they're sitting there. You know, the other ports obviously can't handle them, or maybe they're contracted to go to Los Angeles. They can't go to Florida because they can't make it through the Panama Canal. They're not going to sail around Cape Horn. It's the roughest stretch of water in the world. So there they sit. And so this compounds the problem. I think they're building a wider Panama Canal. That would actually be good for us because then we could take more west ships in an eastern port here. But that's not happening yet. So it says the sister port of Long Beach did implement a so-called 24/7 operations several months ago, a magic wand that President Nobody dangled for the Port of Los Angeles on October 13th. But in reality, 24/7 at Long Beach means only one of six terminals and only Monday to Thursday. Apparently, 24/7 in government speak isn't what it means to the rest of us. Not surprisingly, since it's not the union's job to make things easy, it's fought automation for years to protect its $200,000 salaries while imposing arcane rules on truckers that make it a nightmare to do pickups. Okay, now we were sort of, you know, speculating that I thought the crane operators were definitely in the six figures, and people are like, no, they don't make that much. You know, yeah, they do, $200,000. You know, that's half of what Dr. Fascist makes. You know, we're talking serious money here. The chokehold is sending factories and retailers nationwide into panic mode, not only for the risk the company Christmas season, but for the critical supplies and materials needed to run their own factories. I just talked about that with, you know, just-in-time production, okay? Home Depot and Target resorted to chartering their own ships only to run into the meat grinder of inland supply chains, that'd be the truckers and warehouses. Analysts are predicting that the chaos could last into 2023. Well, we do have a midterm election in 2022, but if the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, follow their form, the Marxists will steal the election and the geldings will let them. So I don't have much faith in 2022 yet because I don't see any change in the GOP, the gelding old party, that they're going to do anything different in 2022 than they did in 2020. If they don't do something different in 2020, there isn't going to be a 2022. The Democrats will still be in charge, which is, I think, the plan anyway, but that's for another show. Article says, because imported resins and materials are necessary in food production and delivery, even grocery store shelves are now clearing across the country. Nearly 20% of beverage and bakery products are out of stock nationwide, while Costco and Sam's Club stores are reimposing purchase limits on some goods. I saw the headline for a really bizarre story. I haven't pulled it up yet, but Gene, have you heard about the cardboard shelves? They're actually putting pictures of food on the shelves to make them look full. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, we'll get that. We'll get that going at some point. But I've heard. I know I saw a story headline, and I haven't pursued it because I had a bunch of other things I want to do. But yeah, if that's what's going on, that's crazy. Here's another thing too: bread, you know, should be produced locally. You know, meat should be slaughtered and prepared locally. Juices,
right,
especially in Florida, should be grown and produced locally. So if you want to, if you're worried about your bread, meat, and juices coming nationally from some freezer compartment, if you don't want your, you know, if you don't want a Chilean or Argentinian beef in the wintertime because, you know, in Canada, in northern United States, it's too cold and they're not slaughtering or whatever, you know, the meat production's down, buy local. Go to farmers markets. You know, there is a way out of this that would actually be a really good change for our economy. Buy local. Buy local honey. I do. Buy local produce. You know, buy as many local things as you can, and the supply chain is a lot more is a lot easier to control and fix and regulate and you know, adapt if it's done locally. So one of the things I'm hoping that will happen is a lot more stuff is produced, grown, harvested, and sold locally. All right. Gee, when you have a comment on that or anything else, you know, like I say, just jump back in here. All right. So it says here, Park Ships.
Greg, hold on.
Oh, go ahead.
I just had to unmute because I sneezed, but I just want to say that's a great idea, but also help each other out. Look, and you can say, well, I was prepared. My neighbor wasn't. You don't know why they're not, but just kind of keep each other in line. It's, or just kind of look at each other and just say, hey, I'm going to do this. Would you want me to pick you some up? Or, if, you know, they're struggling, say, hey, I got something extra. And the sad thing is you can say, yeah, you have something extra now, but you don't know what you're going to have next week. You're right. But I think this is where we need to come together, too, as a people. And because we, unfortunately, our government is failing us big time. And so we need to take control of how we handle things, how we do things, how we survive positively, as positively as we can. And without being, you know, totally ruthless and just self-centered, because bottom line is this, it's like we need other people in our life. And you never know, that neighbor may be able to help you out. Maybe it's not for, with food or something like that, but maybe your electric went out and they can come and get your, you know, fix whatever needs to be fixed so it can get back on. Because I just know electricians here were close to where I live. It's like, man, if you were an electrician, you could make a good living because they wait months to get electricians out to do things. So just whatever it is, it could be anything. Shoot, someone that cuts your hair, maybe they'll cut your hair. Who knows? It's like, just, yeah, work with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a great thing. I am more of the school of self-reliance. And so, you know, I think Gene's absolutely right. You know, cooperate wherever you can, but I think you're better off. Well, I shouldn't say better off. That's not quite accurate, but it's, I think you should also take care of yourself and you should take care of your family. And I'll tell you what's really big right now is food prep. The survival food, you know, the food that lasts 25 years is really popular right now. And so people are stocking up, storing up, and even canned goods will last a couple of years. So, you know, those of us that have lived in earthquake zones and hurricane zones or blizzard zones, and I seem to have been all three, and I sort of joke around, I was in the blizzard 78 in New England, I was in the earthquake of 89 in San Francisco, and I got Hurricane Sally last year And I told my friends, I said, I think I'll move next to a volcano next. I mean, why not? Sample all that life has to offer. I'm not joking around because people died in all of those things. And so I'm not trying to make too much light of it. But the point is that this is fun. This is something that we can do. That's something that we can do for ourselves to be more self-reliant, to shop locally, buy some canned goods. And what you do is you can sort of have a rotating basis. So if canned goods last 2 years, well, at the end of this year, you go through those and then you buy another set of canned goods for another 2 years. So you kind of have a rotating basis, for how it works. Anyway, it looks like I got Cindy online. I'm going to bring her a little bit earlier. I still want to talk about this a little bit more, but just for the fun of it. Cindy Cagle is one of our two medical freedom reps here, which is absolutely wonderful. So I'm going to bring her on for just a bit. We'll get into her report in a second. Cindy, do you have any comments on this, just out of curiosity? And I know it's not your area of expertise, but I tend to like to get people's views who aren't, a specialist in any particular thing, just to see how it affects you. What do you think?
Well, I certainly think that canned goods are a great idea in the current climate. I'm not awake yet. I'll be real honest.
Okay, well, just hang there, and I'll get you in there. Let me give you another, 5 minutes to kind of get your coffee. You want to mute your line? I'll mute your line for a bit. I'll get back to you in a bit. Yeah, surprise. So welcome to Action Radio. You call in, I'm going to call on you. And if you don't, just let me know ahead of time, especially my guests and reporters. If you want to sit on the line, listen for a little bit. But I'm always curious about different. Viewpoints about people that, especially Claire Lopez, hates it when I do it. I'll ask her a question that's not her area of expertise of foreign intelligence, foreign affairs, and it's like, because you're a smart person, so just, it's nice to be able to cross over different grounds. So I wonder
Hey, Greg, I do want to make a comment, though, sorry. I think this is showing us, like you were saying, how you need to rely on yourself, what you do. That's that's wonderful, because I think once we rely on somebody else, then we're giving our power away. However, I think we need to quit relying on the government. I think if anybody out there still thinks that the government is there to help us and is looking out for us, if this is the last quite a few months and it's going to continue on, because I heard some really horrible things yesterday that they're doing to the military, I just want to say, if you think the government, anyone in the government is looking out for your best interest at this point, I would say, I pray for you, because they are not. And so we need to take care of ourselves. Yes.
Yeah. I'm really curious what you heard about the military, because I know they have, mandatory vaccine stuff that's going on, and I really want to find out about that. And we could probably do it during Cindy's report, which would be interesting to bring that up. I'll see what she knows about it. So we'll get to that in just a bit here. I want to cover a bit more of this article, and we can, like I say, we can pick it up at 7 o'clock afterwards. And Jonathan Mosley, our legal expert, will join us at 7:30. I'm going to ask him basically the same stuff about any of the mandates that are out there, especially health workers, airline pilots, firefighters, police, things like that. And the other one I want to talk about is federal contracts, because I know various people who work for companies that work for the government. The feds are saying that Southwest, because they're a government contractor for, I guess, carrying the mail or something like that, that the government, that the Biden insurrection, President Nobody, can impose all these rules on them simply because they do business with the government. That doesn't make any sense to me. Because the government's so intrusive in so many different areas, it's like saying something affects interstate commerce. They had a famous case of a grain elevator, which sold grain to local truckers, That affects interstate commerce. Well, no, it doesn't. I sell it to local truckers. Well, those trucks go interstate. So therefore, it's interstate commerce. People eat bread, people eat wheat, bread from that wheat, across the country. What? So anyway, so what the government says is interstate commerce, and what they say is government contracts. It's all part of collecting power. And again, you cannot trust a government that steals the government to do things legally afterwards, because in the act of stealing the government illegally, everything that follows, it would be reasonable to expect would be illegal also. All right. So I got back to the scene. So the choke, this is back to the article. For those that missed it, it's from the Daily Signal. It was written by Peter St. Ong, or Ong, O-N-G-E. He is a research fellow at the Roe Institute for Economic Policy Studies, part of the Heritage Foundation. This was from October 15th. So back to my because now I lost my place. Here you go. Okay, park ships. So let's go back to ships. He says, park ships are easy to see, but ports are just the beginning. Once goods get off the ship, there aren't enough truckers or enough chassis, that would be truck bodies, I guess, to carry the containers, or enough warehouse space, or enough rail capacity. Well, that's the whole transportation link right there. It says railhead waits are now averaging 10 to 20 days, while warehouses in Los Angeles are already 98.8% full. It's now so expensive to import that container ships are going back empty, leaving U.S. products to sit on trains too full to take new loads, which back up the ports and block them from unloading incoming ships. It's layer after layer with supply chains failing at every stage like dominoes. I'm going to hold it there simply because I want to get to Indy, and then we'll talk about the rest of the supply chain. But this is, you know, this is dominoes. I mean, you think about it. One thing affects everything: the price of fuel, the availability of warehouse space, the paid-off workers that aren't working, the truckers, the cost of fuel for the truckers, the railroad lines, you know, and the fact that containers is such a marvelous innovation in transportation. In the old days, they used to have this program where the ships would have the cranes, and the ships would load nets of cargo. That's how they used to do it. And then someone got the bright idea of putting the cranes in the ports, taking them off the ships, and having these things called containers. And what the containers do is they're self-contained units. And you can take a container, you can load it onto a ship, you can load it off a ship, you can put it on a truck, put it on a train, put it anywhere you want, take it directly where it's going, take it to a warehouse. You know, you never have to open it. You never have to open the freight and sort or do anything to it. It's a self-contained container going directly where it needs to go, which I think is fascinating. All right, let's get to Cindy and our one of our two medical freedom reports. And let me know what's happening. Particularly, I think the rally was in Tallahassee, if you were there, but I'm curious if you were, and the impacts from that and what you found and who you talked to and all that. Hi, Cindy. You awake now?
I'm working on it. Good morning. Okay. Yeah, Tallahassee, it was beautiful. I must say I hadn't been there since I was a child, so that in itself was exciting to me. But we had support from all over the state, actually. I was kind of surprised how little representation there was from Tallahassee. I think the majority of us were from other parts of the state, but certainly all there for the same reason, medical freedom, and to support a candidate that's running against Rubio.
You can mention his name. We already talked about him yesterday, Luis Miguel.
Luis Miguel, yeah.
Speak freely, Cindy. I said speak freely about Luis. We're trying to get him on the show. David Jones of Santa Rosa Volunteers knows his campaign person. He talked about that yesterday. So, yeah, I'm probably going to back him. I mean, that's the nice thing about not being an objective journalist but being an advocate. You know, I can have these folks on and say, yeah, we're for you, you know, but I'm still going to ask you questions because I want to sharpen their message. And ideally, they will take citizen legislation from us, and especially if you and I work on a ban on vaccine or and other mandates, that they can take a bill to Congress and prevent, you know, future government insurrections like, you know, President Nobody from doing this again. And so that's something that we can work on. So this is why it's great to have a candidate. I'm hoping to do the same thing with Anthony Sabatini as he's running for Congress. He's been on the show before a couple times. Mm-hmm. And so, but now that he's running for Congress, you know, it's harder to get a hold of him. He's busy. And of course, Matt Gaetz, you know, ever since he started wearing hair gel, hasn't called him. So hair gel is the problem. Okay. So once when he looked like a Boy Scout, he called the show back when I was at WBY, but we haven't been able to reach him. So these politicians, once they get sort of, they take their own propaganda seriously and they get full of themselves and they disappear. So if we can get them before they get to that point, before they get co-opted and TV, you know, infused and start wearing hair gel, then we're all set. We have some good representation. At least that's my goal anyway. Tell me about Louis.
Well, and I hope the goal will be to put people in office that once they get there, they don't morph into something that isn't for the people. That seems to be the trend in politics these days. But I guess that's a whole nother subject.
Well, no, that's an ongoing subject. You're right on. But that happens, and we want to try and you know, fix that as much as possible. But there's only so much you can do, you know, because they get lobbyists and perks and dinner and trips and they get to offered committee chairs and they get campaign, you know, contributions from the party. And then that implies they have to play ball. Okay. So they don't play ball. and they don't get the campaign contributions, they don't get the committee chairs. Their office is scheduled, you know, 15 blocks away, or, you know, in the restrooms. That if you have in Massachusetts, you know, a speaker there scheduled, you know, put somebody's office they didn't like in the men's room. So
really?
Oh yeah, it's a true story. Oh yeah, this is back 30 years ago, but yeah. But anyway, so. Before you get going, we should probably tell a bit about who you are and your organization and ways to reach it. I'm going to start doing that early in the report rather than at the end when we tend to forget. So let's get that for our new listeners, and then let's go back to the rally.
Awesome.
So who are you?
Okay. Well, I am Cindy Cagle with Citizens for Medical Freedom, and we are an organization here in Santa Rosa and Escambia County supporting, the anti-vaccine mandate crap that's going on in our country. We started as support to the Ascension Sacred Heart employees facing the mandates put in place there, and kind of morphed into a community effort for anyone facing these unconstitutional mandates. And we are a grassroots effort to push back and say we're not gonna tolerate what's going on. And unfortunately, so many people are living in fear, or I should say working in fear, to push back. We just want to show our support and let them know that we're going to do everything we can to bring attention to it, to shame these companies that are doing it, and affect change through our legislation.
Are they feeling any shame? Are they feeling any anything? Do they care? What's the response?
In all honesty, probably not. But that's not going to deter me. My goal is to encourage the human spirit to get back to a place where we're supporting each other. I mean, these are our friends and our neighbors being affected by this, and it just seems to me like we've become a society of just kind of worried about yourself, and that's not good for anybody. It takes all of us to be a community.
Well, I'm a firm believer in self-reliance. I was talking to this about Jean just a little bit ago when she's talking about, you know, folks helping each other out. And I see that. I saw that three times, actually. I saw that in New England with the blizzard of 78 I was talking about. And, of course, in San Francisco, we all got out and checked. Everybody checked on the neighbors. We all had a community barbecue that night. So I've seen, the worst of times bring out the best in people. And, of course, Hurricane Sally here brought out some amazing things from people. It's nice to do that all the time, but human nature doesn't work that way. You really, the principal is yourself, and hopefully family, but that's not always the case either. But you can think there's a community out there, but I also think that a lot of individual actions can have a community effect. So in other words, everybody, resisting a job, if your job has an illegal vaccine mandate, there are groups you can join, but it comes down to your individual action. And in everybody's individual action and resisting, the group effect of that is that the companies at some point, it's going to be too costly for them. So I don't know what that balance is. It depends on the company, depends on the area, depends on the specialty, things like that. I mean, how many airline pilots can the airlines fly without? How many are they going to lose because of the ones who complied and actually got the vaccine, are not with us anymore, sadly. So there's two things going on here. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and I would say, while it is, it's each of ours individual responsibility to stand up, there is much more power in numbers. So whether you have gotten the vaccine or not, you should be standing for the basic principle of choice, of if you're going to do something that is unconstitutional to my neighbor, I'm going to stand with that neighbor. And that's going to have a much bigger impact than that one employee that stands by their convictions and says, this isn't right and I'm not going to allow it. And I think
not against groups. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for groups. I form groups here all the time. I've got, 20 pages of groups associated with Action Radio in different areas of specialty, from special investigations, family law, homeschool, all kinds of, I forget them all. There's so many, but But that, so I'm not against groups. What I'm saying is, though, but you, individual action, this is where it starts. And, of course, an individual action is joining a group. You know, it's saying, I want to stand with these people. So that works in two. So you really have to do both. But I want to inspire people to do both so that you look at what you can do as an individual and then carry that to other individuals, and together as a group, obviously you're going to have much more impact. That's what I'm saying, is the group effect of individual action. So I'm not discounting either individual action or the group, because without the group, you know, you don't have the power. I mean, you know, Citizens for Medical Freedom is more powerful because of all the people in it. That's a good thing. So how much effect is the group having? Are you getting any response that you... Anything you can, any revelations? What's going on?
Well, certainly the response from the community when we are out on the sidewalk is overwhelmingly supportive. You know, occasionally you have the angry citizen that's against, I guess, freedom, but overwhelmingly the support is there. I think there's still a lot of fear in the people being affected by this that haven't made the leap to come out and actually stand on the sidewalk, because they're waiting and hoping for this to turn around. And sadly, I don't know that that's going to happen before it gets worse. But yeah, the overwhelming support is there. And I think even, again, if you're not against the vaccine, you certainly should be against mandating something and destroying lives to make it happen when it's not necessary.
Well, none of this is necessary. They're destroying lives by actually taking them with the vaccine when things go horribly wrong. They're destroying lives by kicking people out of their jobs for not taking what's really not a vaccine. It's a genetic modifier. And so either way, the tragedies, you know, don't stop. There's no reason for the mandate. Yeah, and here's the thing I don't understand too, and I wonder if your group could you know, post more of this. The vaccines aren't vaccines. We know they're genetic modifiers. They're designed for the alpha variant of COVID. Well, the alpha variant only lasted for a few months. It was gone last year, probably by last summer. It was gone. So we're talking over a year. What people are being, you know, allegedly vaccinated for doesn't exist. And the worst
and
part
sadly,
is,
sadly, they're moving right ahead with now approving it for 5 and up, which
that's insane.
Tell
me about kids, because I heard kids are statistically, their risk is as close to zero as you can get without actually being there, because some kids are obviously affected. But statistically, the risk for kids 5 to 18 is zero from COVID, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why the mandate?
You know, that is a great question, and I know the people on the other side would argue it's conspiracy theory to think anything, but you have to question the motivation behind vaccinating a segment of society that is nearly not affected by this you know, this COVID. It really breaks my heart to hear the number of parents that are willing and ready to bring their kids to receive these shots. I beg with them to give it some thought, do a little bit of reading, and just consider from the standpoint that your child has a 99.99% chance of being completely unaffected, but even if they are of survivability, not to do something that you can't undo it once you do it, and there are no long-term studies for it. Our kids are our future, and if we're putting something in them that we don't know the long-term effects, what does that look like down the road? I beg parents, please give it some thought. Me, as a parent myself, I don't understand it. Your child is your most precious gift, and it's an instinct to protect them at every level. So why would you do this? I struggle with that.
Yeah, I know Gene wants to make a comment, too. Yeah, go ahead, Gene. I got a question.
I was going to say, when you consider the side effects, the cardio, what is it?
Cardiomyopathy
of the heart. Yes, and it's like when you consider all that stuff, how many children are
more affected negatively by the actual vax than if they would have even gotten COVID.
Yeah.
And then my theory still goes back to they should not need to do it until the border is closed, until everybody in Congress, everybody at the White House has to get vaccinated. But until then, they shouldn't be putting it on children.
Yes. When I heard the news a couple of days ago that the FDA approved it for five-year-olds, and I will point out that was a 17-1 vote to approve that with comments like, we won't know how effective it is until we start, is just, it's concerning. And there again, as a parent, I don't know how it doesn't, it doesn't make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. We must protect our children. It's bad enough that we as adults are fighting this, but our children, that's a whole another segment of society that we must protect.
Yeah, this is maybe a distant issue, but it seems like the left, the controllers, the Marxist, the deep state that stole our government, that you know, is letting all the illegals in to try and destroy our country. Their big thing is abortion. One of their major issues, you know, my body, my choice. You know, sacrifice a lot of people are saying now preborn babies. And I find it fascinating that the same people that are promoting abortion as much as possible are also wanting to shoot up kids with COVID. You know, and I'm wondering if there's a connection that this is just a contempt for kids, that just the kids are disposable, that they just don't see them as you and I see them, you know, as gifts from God. And I think there's a disconnect there that I'm wondering, you know, I never thought about it until we were talking about this morning, but is that part of the same mentality that the people that can abort are also the same people that can shoot up with COVID with these spike proteins? I don't know if there's a connection. It might be interesting to think about that the people that are for independence and control of the individual by the individual, and those of us that want, you know, if you want to take the shot, I'm not going to stop you. I think you're crazy.
Absolutely.
But I'm not going to stop you. You have the right to make bad decisions in this country. You know,
yeah.
And some of those bad decisions turn out to be very good decisions when people are proven right 100 years later. So I understand that. That's why I don't feel the right to criticize people for making the decision, other than to try and persuade and influence them not to do it. But the left, the controllers, the people that believe that they're right, not only are they right, they can tell you what to do. They can make you wear a mask. They make your kids wear a mask. They can make you take something that we've discussed already, you know, that is designed for the Alpha variant, which died out a year ago, which has no effect on you know, they take your 99%+ effective natural immunity and reduce it to like 60-40% after a couple of months, requiring another, you know, shot to try and raise it up again, which is then going to diminish. So this is a diminishing return. They're actually making you take something that drastically lowers your immunity progressively, requiring more and more of it, which will progressively lower your immunity more and more. And all it does, and I heard this recently, like Dr. Malone or some of the folks, and he invented the messenger RNA vaccine as a graduate project. It's quite fascinating. But he said that the what they're trying to vaccinate for, what they're trying to teach your DNA how to do, is a very narrow band of preventing, you know, certain spike proteins are a very small part of the virus, whereas your natural immunity affects many parts of the virus. It affects the spike proteins. It affects the coating, the envelope that the virus is in. Zinc plus your body affects the internal genetic material of the virus. So your natural immunity attacks viruses on all fronts, whereas a COVID shot shoots you up with stuff, hoping your body will teach itself how to make, you know, prevention for it, but it only prevents one particular small part of it. Have you heard anything about that? It might be worth pursuing. Go ahead.
Well, certainly I'm not a doctor, but as a mother, I look at it from a very simplistic viewpoint that while they argue the vaccine is safe and effective, so is a Tylenol for a child. But you don't give your child a Tylenol if it's not necessary. And this is as simple as it's not necessary. Your child is 99.99% chance of not even knowing they have COVID. And if they do, surviving it. So rely on that natural immunity and don't give them something that is untested on children and we don't know the long-term effects. It's really that simple. So I really do, and it was alarming to me to hear people, parents talking. They were asking people in the community, you know, how they felt about vaccinating their child 5 and up. And I was alarmed to hear that I believe 32% of parents said, sure, yeah, as soon as the FDA approves it, they will bring their child to receive this vaccination. And a lot of why they were doing it was to do things like travel and get their life back. You know, as a parent there again, I would go to the ends of the world to protect my child, and if that meant not traveling to prevent getting this vaccine, that would be my personal decision. And as a mom, I don't understand any other thought process.
Oh, no, it makes perfect sense to me. And I was a father. I raised a daughter. So, you know, I'm right there with you.
But
what is fascinating about this is that everything they're doing, most of the people that are doing this have to be coerced, threatened, or sent and presented before them. If it were just voluntary, if only the voluntary people took this, then we'd be fine, because I don't care. I mean, like I say, I mean, I do care. But the point is, I'm not going to scream and yell about people who want to do this voluntarily.
Right,
I'm going to try and educate
them.
I'm kind of trying to show them. But you look at the coercion from the propaganda coming out of the government, from the censorship from big tech, from the financial incentives. It's free. It's not free. We're all paying for it. You know, the taxes are paying for this. You know, I mean, there's nothing free about it. But the Fed, you know, it's like, well, we have access. And then when that didn't work, then they started getting, you know, the screws started to tighten. Now we're going to say you can't travel and you can't, you need a passport. And of course, that's all BS. And now it's to the point where people are losing their jobs. So they keep tightening down the screws to make you do it. Okay. The more they prove that they have to make you do it, the more that we prove that, you know, we don't need it, shouldn't have it, and there's something wrong.
Right.
So not dealing with the problem here. But it's amazing how progressively coercive to, you know, downright extortion that this is getting. And that proves to me that we shouldn't have it. There's something very wrong. If this many people are saying no, you know, if it's a good thing, people would do it. It's like the difference between, you know, World War II and Vietnam. They didn't need the draft in World War II because everybody knew it was a just cause and they went. And people willingly, you know, gave their lives to defend our country and stop, you know, stop Hitler and stop Hirohito in Japan. And they did that, and, you know, the world better for it. Vietnam was a whole different story. They had to have a draft because nobody wanted to go fight a foreign war in a country that was not going to come here and invade our shores. And everybody knew it. You know, so the, is the cause just? Well, is the cause of this just? No, it's not. Okay?
No.
And the proof that it's not just is that it has to be forced. You know, and the lack of, you know, the from lack of information to outright extortion of your job. But here's the thing. I still want to get back to this. I wish that you and other groups would focus more on this. This whole thing is designed. It's not a vaccine. It's a gene shot. It's for a virus that doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't work anyway because it lowers your immunity, and natural immunity so far, you know, precludes the use of this in 99.9, you know, whatever percent of the population, depending on how old you are. You know, and I think I had it back, you know, 2 years ago, and I was still over 60 then. I was a high-risk group. I got sick for a couple of days. You know, it was like a bad cold. It was like the worst cough I've ever had. I mean, it was miserable. And anybody who listened to the show 2 years ago in January, beginning of January, knows how bad I sounded. I'm you know, I never got tested, but I'm convinced that was COVID because it had all the symptoms except a fever, and I didn't lose taste or smell, at least as far as I know. Probably didn't eat much. I might have lost it. I don't know. Point being, I haven't been sick since. You know, so I have natural immunity, not only to COVID, but pretty much everything apparently, because I haven't been sick since that. And I've, you know, lead a pretty crazy lifestyle with you know, the hours and the work that goes into making this work. But I wish, you know, you could do more with that. So find the stories, do the research, bring out more that this is, it's an obsolete gene shot for something that doesn't exist. And I don't think that's something really in the forefront of people's minds as much as it could be. Curious what you think.
No, I'll agree. You don't hear much about that. And that gets into the science part of it, which is way above my pay grade. But
well, you can still study. See, I want to jump into for that too, because you don't have to be. You know, people. This is the other thing too, is that if you're not an expert, you can't judge, you can't make decisions, you can't make choices. Mm-hmm. You know, but you can read the same reports that I can read. I can read the same reports that the doctors read. You know, if it's in English and it's logical and it's, you know, we're intelligent people. You know, most people are intelligent enough to read these studies. If you take a decent summary, I mean, I don't know the last, you know, ketone X variant, you know, something ASE ending lipid nanoprotein. You know, I don't know all that crap, but I don't have to. Just explain to me, does this work? I can explain to you how a virus kills another virus. I can explain to you how hydroxychloroquine and zinc work. I can explain to you very simply that hydroxychloroquine destroys the protein wall around the genetic material of a virus. That's not hard to understand. I can explain to you how zinc kills the genetic material once the hydroxychloroquine has opened the virus up and the DNA material is accessible. Okay, so they work together. You need them both. It's a symbiotic relationship. The zinc destroys the genetic material of the virus, prevents it from replicating. Hydroxychloroquine opens the envelope so the zinc can get to that genetic material. Is there anything about that that's hard to understand?
No, but that's very impressive because I have no understanding of that. But I do know as an American citizen, I've been able to have a relationship with my doctor for 50-some-odd years that involved only me and my doctor. And that's the country I want to continue to live in. You know, my neighbor doesn't know my health status. They shouldn't know my health status. And we've gotten away from the doctor-patient relationship in our society, and that's never okay. That evolves into government medicine and one size fits all. And just as a human being, I know that's not a good situation, and that's what's made our country different from everything else. I want to preserve that, and I want to get back to that.
Thanks for listening. Gene, did you want to comment?
Yes, I did want to comment.
Yep.
But
yep. You should use that more often.
I'm all for people taking, you know, doing the research, looking things up, making their own decisions. However, as a medical person, I can't tell you how many people, their health got messed up because they looked online, Wikipedia, whatever they looked at, and it said this and do this, and it was something totally different. It's like, remember, this is, you are not trained. You may understand it to a point, but it's like that may not be the whole truth as far as what you're reading may not fit your circumstance. So please look at it, but always talk to someone that, or not always because some things it doesn't matter, but for more important things, talk to someone that does know more to make sure what you see, what you're reading is how it is and not that it's a little bit different in your situation.
Mm.
Well, you can always ask questions based on what you read, too. I mean, I think an informed patient asks better questions. You know, when I had to go for open heart surgery, I knew as much as I could know, and I brought those questions to the doctor, and was rather impressed, by the way. You know, but you can, anything, any condition you have, you can learn about it and be better informed and better prepared. You know, when they start talking about stuff, and they say, well, I don't know if you understand that. Well, yeah, I do. I looked it up last week. Oh, okay. You know, so
yeah,
you
but
can,
still, sometimes it's not the whole thing, and so it can actually be dangerous.
Yeah.
That, you know, well, it can be dangerous. So I want to caution people. Yes, look things up, but don't think you're an expert just because you looked it up, because there's maybe many other factors involved. And I do agree with the doctor-patient relationship. And the sad thing is in the military, even when you have the military doctors, they're just I don't want to say puppets, but they're just propagating what they're told from the higher ups as far as the vaccine and stuff goes.
What's going on?
And that's exactly what
even for kids.
Led up.
Yeah, if the kids can be mandated that they can get these the vax, okay. But which one was mandated? Was it the one that's out now, or is it the one that's to be produced?
Oh, no, that's the difference between approved and authorized. The ones that are out now are authorized under an emergency use authorization, which says that there is no other alternative, safe alternative currently available. That is a lie. Ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine have been available for decades. They work. So the emergency use authorization is being misused it's a lie. This is why Dr. Zelenko and I wrote a bill to fix the FDA and overhaul this whole procedure of emergency use authorizations. Unfortunately, nobody in Congress has taken it up, even though we've sent it to a whole bunch of them. Cindy, I'll send it to you, too. You should have this bill that you can talk about. But what's going on in the military? Tell me more about that. I'm curious.
Hold on. I just want to talk about, and I just saw this yesterday. So I don't know. I mean, some of the stuff you get maybe out months ago, and they just rehash it through the powers that be on the Internet. But they were saying there was this big to-do yesterday about the people in Washington are getting ivermectin. And in the Congress, Senate, and all those. And so it's interesting that they're pushing the vax on people and won't let people get ivermectin, making it difficult for them. You know, you can't go get it from doctor, you know, unless it's a special doctor that's willing to put their license on the line. But the thing is, then they can get it. And then they're seeing how, the costs differ. And so it's just crazy, crazy, crazy. I don't know. So I don't know if that really was just breaking yesterday, that now they're finding out that they're taking it or took it, or if it's been, this article was out quite a while ago because I wasn't able to find the date on it, but I just thought that was interesting. Well,
and they're also giving that to the illegals that are coming in through our border. They're not vaccinating them. They're giving them ivermectin.
Really?
Tell
me. That's the first I've heard of this. So where do you, is there a source on that you can post? I mean, let me know. I'll be curious.
Okay, I will get that to you.
Yeah.
So there again, that leads to questioning why there is such a motivation to take away the constitutional rights of everyday Americans and, you know, remove them from their jobs because they don't want to get a vaccine, but you have people coming through our borders in our country with unknown medical status, and you're not requiring them to be vaccinated, but you're giving them ivermectin, the very medicine that average citizens would take as a preventative for this disease that you say is so deadly. It really just breeds a level of distrust.
Well, it's not that deadly. That's the other thing, too. Unless you're at a high risk group with comorbidities, it's not that deadly, obviously, at the 99% level. This is fascinating to me. And what I bet you'll find, if you look it up, and I'll look it up when we get a chance here, but I bet you'll find that they're using it. They're going to say, well, we have to prevent parasites. We have to prevent other diseases being brought into the country. But you know damn well they're giving it to stop COVID. You know, and that is fascinating.
And
we can expose that in a big way and say, wait a minute, I can be giving these folks ivermectin. I'll tell you why they're giving them ivermectin, because illegal aliens don't have money. This is about money. This is about profit.
Yes.
This is about soaking the taxpayer.
And if you're going to put a bunch of people,
they don't have health insurance.
Yeah, they don't have health insurance.
You're going to put them out of their jobs because they're not getting the vaccine, then why are you not lining up every single person coming into this country with an unknown medical history and giving them this vaccine?
Yeah. Let me tell you something else I found I want your reaction to. This is in a National File. FDA committee members reviewing Pfizer vaccine for children have worked for Pfizer, have big Pfizer connections. And you talked about those 17 of the 17 people that voted to have it go to the kids, only one didn't. That's the one person who's not going to get the job. I bet you all those other folks have lined up jobs in big pharma after. But here's what it says. The FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, apparently they held a meeting Tuesday. So this is this is a couple of days old news. But it also said members, and this is still current, members include a former vice president of Pfizer Vaccines, a recent Pfizer consultant, a recent Pfizer research grant recipient, a man who mentored a current top Pfizer vaccine executive, a man who runs a center that gives out Pfizer vaccines, the chair of a Pfizer data group, the guy who proudly photographed taking a Pfizer vaccine, and numerous people who are already on the record supporting coronavirus vaccines for children. Meanwhile, recent FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb is on Pfizer's board of directors. Now, what's the one company that keeps coming up here? Have you noticed the pattern?
Yes.
It's Pfizer. Okay. So here's another thing, too, to look at. You don't hear much about Johnson & Johnson or Moderna. You don't hear about AstraZeneca because it's not approved here. It's approved in Europe. But Pfizer is winning the vaccine wars. Why? Money.
That's very interesting.
Money.
That is,
they're spending the most money.
That's
and they're hiring the most people.
Though, too, to think mm-hmm. that's despicable to think that that's you know how they get it. They approve it or you know say oh it this needs to be done with kids. So they're not looking out for the well-being of the kids, and not that anybody really thought they would be. But you know you got to wonder why just one person didn't vote. You know, only one person voted against it, and there, that says it all right there.
Yep. So
and that should be legal. That should be legal. You should not mm-hmm. be able to be on dealing with any type of medicines when you're like that to profit. You know, that's awful.
And so, I would just like to mention legislatively, you know, we had our legislative delegation meeting this week with Senator Doug Broxson and House Representatives J.R. Williamson and Alex Andrade. And
how'd that go?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I left very disheartened. You know, there were physicians there talking about why this isn't necessary and the impacts that it's having on the community. And afterwards, I made a point to talk to Alex Andrade, and mm-hmm. I was very disheartened by, well, A, he said emphatically there was nothing that could be done about the employers of 100 or more employees legislatively. Mm-hmm. That
yes, there is.
that is something that based on our Constitution that we don't want them intervening in that. And you know, there again, I'm not a lawyer, but I want
you don't have
them
to be.
To do
he is
something.
Let me
yes,
focus right on this is a critical point. This is absolutely critical. The lawyers who are running for office and hold political office are telling you that nothing can be done. That's a bunch of BS, okay?
And he
so
was very, very repetitive about that.
Oh.
And I think what concerned me even more is that mm-hmm. he was very unmoved by the direction of our country. It was very eye-opening, and like I said, it was very disheartening, and I was informed that his wife works at Baptist Hospital, one of the most disgusting COVID policies to date, and he was unaware of it.
What do you
just,
mean? Well, no, he was aware of it. He just didn't want you to know that. So what's going on
well,
at the Baptist Hospital? I'm mentioning, you know, names of people who aren't public. He's public, so you talk about him. I don't want to, you know, mention his wife unless she's public also. But what's mm-hmm. going on at the Baptist Hospital, which is public?
Well, they have in their policy written restrictions that the unvaccinated employees are not able to sit with the vaccinated employees. And
wow,
that's actually a good thing. That's a good thing. It keeps the
no, but that's just sad. Sad because that's segregation.
Exactly, and something that we have evolved from over the last 30 years. How that is not alarming to one of our representatives is disheartening.
Well, he believes in segregation. Yeah, see, now is he a Democrat or Republican in name only?
He's a Republican.
A okay, so he's a rhino. All right. I know a little bit about Alex Andrade. I know a little bit about Doug Broxton. Apparently, he ran like a little baby coward through the parking lot to get away from someone who wanted to ask him some questions. You know, I wish there was a camera of that. I heard Doug Broxton bravely, as the Monty Python would say, bravely ran away. You know, every day a monster coming. Yeah, okay. So here's why I created Action Radio, exactly for what happens in your experience. The legislators are not listening to us. Now, the question is, who funds their campaigns? How much is Big Pharma in our state and at our state representative level, at the state senator and the state rep level? The governor's called a special legislative session to get rid of these mandates. Who do you think is going to write that mandate? I'll tell
our
you now.
Representatives.
Think again. I'm not criticizing you. I'm not picking on you. But who do you think, who do you really think is going to write that mandate, that anti-mandate law?
Oh, well, big pharma.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Now, how do you counter them doing that? This is business as usual. And what we're getting to is the reason I created Action Radio. So how do you counter big pharma's influence over legislation, over the exact legislation? And the answer
well,
is that I have.
Well, it is we write
Someone
our
else
own
write
legislation,
it.
But I don't know how we're competing with big pharma when legislators that I'm talking with seem mm-hmm. unmoved or unmotivated to...
Well, then we move and motivate them. And the best way to move and motivate them is to direct your votes somewhere else. So the whole point of citizen legislation is to offer a better solution than they could ever come up with themselves, not because they can't do it, it's because they won't do it because they would conflict with their donors too much, okay? So the money, you have to defeat the money, and the only way in order to defeat the money is with more votes than money. So in other words, if we have the votes, if we publicize this, if your group talks to all the members of your group and say not only, you know, it's not enough just to complain and write emails and letters and call them up and say we want you to do something. If you have something specific in your hand, if you have a bill that's better than anything they could write, because we wrote it, okay? And it's very simple. We write it for people. We write it for us. We write it, we the citizens. This is how we govern. And then we take it to media and it goes on talk shows and you talk about it here and everywhere you go. And all of a sudden people, and they have a rallying point. They can say, I want that bill. I want that bill. That's the bill I want. Now the legislature has to compete their bill with our bill. That's a totally different argument. Now, I don't know how it's going to work out because no one's ever done this before. But that's why we are here. That's why I'm here at Action Radio, is to write better legislation than the legislators would themselves because they can't. They have too much of a conflict of interest. So we're going to try and make it easy for them to do the right thing. Cindy.
And I think people just need to keep paying attention. Yeah, where's Matt Gaetz in all this? You know, I still think he needs to be voted out. He's doing nothing for you guys down there.
I don't. I think
he's a pretty boy. I just think he does a lot of talk and stuff in his chest and does nothing.
Yeah. I'm not convinced yet because I've seen the people who are going to run against him, and they would not be better. They just wouldn't. I mean, he's got the brains. He's got the ability to do this. He's got the ability to ask great questions in the Inquisition hearings. He has the potential to be an incredible legislator. He's not using it because I think it's been co-opted by, the hair gel crowd, the fame, the TV personality, the things
like
that.
So that's
I want to try and bring him back.
Then.
Well, and I will
because
say...
Because he let it go to his head.
Hold on, Jane. Hold on a second. Cindy?
I will say we've been communicating with J.R. Williamson, and he gives me hope because he does seem genuinely concerned about what's going on. The compassion is there, to the extent that he can affect change. I think he is our only hope in this area.
We'll call him Obi-Wan then. Obi-Wan Williamson.
Yeah.
Help me, Obi-Wan. You're my only hope. We need Obi-Wan. We need J.R. Williamson to help us. Force is strong with this one.
Because it takes one person to start making a difference, and other people will follow. But when you have people that are just looking more out for themselves and how it can make them look good and, mm-hmm. Whatever, that doesn't help anybody but themselves.
Well, this is actually incredible information. As far as J.R. Williamson goes, because he's the person we need to talk to. So when you and I sit down and write this, and I have a couple other folks in mind, I want to kind of put a group together to or just exchange stuff, online with some ideas. We need to know exactly where the law is. I think David mentioned it yesterday, Section 720 of the Florida Code. We need to go into Section 20, look and see exactly where a mandate ban would go, and we need to write it. And the writing of it is very simply. There shall be no vaccine or other medical mandates in the state of Florida. I mean, there's your bill. Effectively, that's it. And that's all you really need to say. This is so deceptively simple. It's scary. You don't need 5,000 pages of BS like comes out of Congress right now for their stimulus bogus bills. So the other thing about citizen legislation, it's really easy, really direct. Sometimes it's one sentence. Sometimes it's one word. My vaccine product liability bill basically says, In federal law, section or Title 42, Section 300, BBB-65, whatever the code is, it goes from there shall not be product liability for vaccines to there shall be product liability for vaccines. All I did was took out the word not. That's it.
And
that's
I guess
the
I
bill.
Need to correct myself. I believe Representative Andrade did say that they will move legislation to hold the companies that are requiring the mandates liable. They'll have to assume the liability if they're forcing the vaccine. But what does that do for all the people between now and then that have had to get it? And I'm looking for something as simple as you can't mandate an experimental use medical decision.
Well, I would say you can't mandate anything medical, because the Nuremberg Code, international law, prevents, any medical procedure without informed consent. Well, first of all, it requires you to be informed, and second, it requires you to give your consent. So there's no the only thing that is medically necessary that you might do, through due process that might be against somebody's will is a quarantine when they're sick. Okay. So in other words, if someone has a like Typhoid Mary, for example, would be the perfect example of somebody that had typhoid, spread it all over London, I believe, back, 100 or 200 years ago. Someone who knew it, had it, didn't care, drank the water, did whatever she did to do this, to spread typhoid. That is someone you can quarantine. If someone is sick, you can quarantine them. That is a legitimate public health function because you've been through due process. The due process is you got sick. Okay, and you have a communicable disease, but that's it. That's the only thing I can think of that would be a medical requirement that could be done against your will. And even then, they're not affecting you. They're just quarantining you, just keeping you away from everybody else for a temporary amount of time as long as you're contagious. That makes sense. Okay, that's not a violation.
And I think we were all willing
to
do that last year.
Yeah.
We were all on board, but this has gotten so far out of
control. That was different. They were quarantining the healthy people. You can't do that. That's unconstitutional. That's a denial of your constitutional rights. To quarantine a healthy person is illegal. Ooh, gotcha on that one. What do you think?
But I think from a humanity standpoint, we were all on board. Let's do whatever it takes to protect one another.
No. Permit me to respectfully disagree with you. That I call them dictator DeSantis. I wrote an open letter, in an article. And this is back when the intelligent conservative was, or the intellectual conservative was a, a great website until it got hacked, and now you can't find it. But I said very clearly that you can't close the beaches. And I've told the story tons of times. As soon as the governor, when he was dictator DeSantis, issued a stay-at-home order, I went out driving with my windows open, blasting country music out the window and singing as loud as I could. But screw you, governor. I'm not going to quarantine myself. I'm healthy. And if I was sick, I'd stay home. Why? Because I'm sick. In fact, it's not only personally responsible, it's the right thing. If you're sick, you don't want to go out because you're sick. Okay?
So well,
sick people generally stay home.
Well, I think my point of view at that point was I didn't know. None of us seem to know, and in an abundance of caution, and to be
none of us
to be responsible. That's the decision I made, and I was okay with it. 2 weeks seemed, acceptable. And,
Cindy,
and maybe
I agree with you.
Maybe that's the slippery slope.
And the reason I say that is because how can anybody say, "Oh, I knew it was different"? That's bullshit. We didn't know what this was.
Yes.
Nobody
I knew.
I knew.
I'll tell you how I knew.
You had no clue because they told us, it wasn't going to be here. It's going to be very little, whatever. We didn't even know at that time really where it started from, what it started from, any of that. And so it's like, obviously fear played a big role in that. But it's not only that. It's like Trump supposedly asked his medical gurus, and you got to wonder, what side they were on. And I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just saying, were they really into finding out what was best on how to keep, not cure it, contain it, whatever. I don't know. But when it first came out, really nobody, how can you say you knew?
I didn't know
anything about it.
I'll tell you how I can say
That is where misinformation comes from. And it can really hurt and destroy things. And not saying you wouldn't have been right. And no, I'm not saying that at all. But I mean, we need to look at what's going on instead of, I just knew.
I just knew. And let me tell you how I knew. Okay. I had Bill Gertz, who is one of the best foreign intelligence correspondents in the country. on February 25th on Action Radio in 2020, before any of this really broke, talking about the Wuhan lab and the origins of COVID. I've had Dr. Mikovits and other folks confirm that Dr. Fascist, who we affectionately call Dr. Fauci around here, Dr. Fascist knew in 2005 that hydroxychloroquine killed SARS-CoV-1. And since SARS-CoV-1 is about 72% of the genome of SARS-CoV-2, it also kills SARS-CoV-2. Okay, these are viruses that can have protein wall broken down, and then the zinc destroys the genetic material. I knew, because of the study by Dr. Dieter Raoult in Marseille, France, that chloroquine and later hydroxychloroquine kills COVID. I knew because there were a bunch of studies that I read around that. I knew because I did a whole research one, and it only took an afternoon to do this, on the many ways you can kill a virus without a vaccine. They were only talking about vaccines. I knew, and I broadcast it. And I broadcast it March 2nd of 2020. I knew that viruses kill viruses. I knew that viruses and drugs can kill viruses. I know that there are drugs that act like a laser targeting system that allow drugs, that allow both drugs and viruses to kill other viruses. I have a bunch of articles in my early COVID article file saying there is no pandemic. We have the cure. There's nothing to worry about. This is all a bunch of nonsense. I've got the articles. I can repost them, unless they've been scrubbed from the internet. I knew. Dr. Zelenko knew. Dr. Mikovits knew. Dr. Dieter Raoult knew. Doctors all over this country knew that this was a bunch of nonsense. There was no pandemic. But we were silenced. But we knew. And I've never changed from that day, from March 2nd. I've never wavered one iota from that the COVID is a real virus. But the response to it is tyrannical. And the Constitution does not have an on and off switch. You cannot restrict rights. It doesn't matter how bad the pandemic, it doesn't matter how bad the nuclear war, it doesn't matter what you have, the Constitution is always in force. Okay? There is no public health mandate that can supersede your constitutional rights, period. There is no clause in the Constitution that says it can be suspended for any reason. Okay? So as for knowing, yes, we definitely knew. So when DeSantis said, and I'm respectfully disagreeing with both of you here, that when the right thing to do because we didn't know was to stay home and all that kind of stuff, that was a bunch of nonsense, okay? You know, it had to be stopped. The idea that you're closing the beaches, of course, we turned out to be right. The beaches have ultraviolet light. Well, guess what ultraviolet light does? It kills viruses. Fresh air, salt air kills viruses. Hot sand, you know, it's an inhospitable environment. So the more people were out, the more people got fresh air, the more people got exercise, the lower their stress level, the healthier they were, the more weight they lost, the better they were in their immune systems. Staying home, locking up, closing down businesses, causing financial hardship, doing all the horrible things that were done with lockdowns and masks, suppressing people, putting them in these stupid masks that are breeding grounds for every disease you can think of. It's like a nice, warm, moist petri dish in front of your face. You know, we knew it was wrong. And we always knew it was wrong. And we said so from the very beginning. So there were a bunch of us who actually did know. The problem, like I said before, we got censored. We got kicked off Facebook. Our broadcasts were limited. They were shadow banned. They were everything else. But we knew. Just want to make that point. Wow.
Good.
What do you think?
No, I mean, good. And yeah. You can sit back. But it's like even back then with where I was going. I mean, I worked mm-hmm. with some very knowledgeable people. And no, they weren't the experts like you had on. But, you know, you did the best you could with the information you had. And you could say, well, we had all this information. Yes, but not everybody had knowledge, that information. And, you know, not everybody, you look at the government, maybe not everybody wanted that information out there. No, but mm-hmm. it's always easier, too, to look back a year later, be an armchair quarterback and say, coulda, shoulda, woulda. It's like all we could do is the best we could do with the information we have. It's all I'd say is, yes, then it's like, good job for getting that information out there. But it's like then we need to do a better job of continuing to get the information out there. But it's difficult because if you even look at the vaccine mandates now and we're getting information out there and there's two total different polarizing groups, those for it, those against it. And unfortunately, if we ever know, because we're going to long be dead. But as far as I don't want to say who was right or wrong, but really, if the people that got the vaccines, does it turn out like we're said? I mean, I even heard some really horrible things about the vaccine last night, but I can't say if it's true, not whatever, you know, so it will take time to see if what's predicted comes about, or is it just talk?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to hold it here because I want to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece because we're going to have Jonathan join us in a couple of minutes, actually the bottom of the hour, and then Claire's going to come on. And once we get those two on, that's it. We have no more time for anything. So let me hold you there. Cindy, thank you so much for your report. If you want to give your contact information one more time, let's do that. Let me play our piece then, which is a little bit long, but I tried editing it, and I couldn't think of anything that I really could take out and still have it justify itself. So let's do that. Thank you both, Gene, Cindy. Thank you for a really great discussion. I think we've covered a lot of ground. And on this show, we can disagree, and it's okay. That's all part of getting the best information out there. So I welcome disagreement. I'll challenge you, but I still welcome the disagreement. Cindy,
yes.
Contact information, and then I got to start something else here.
Yeah, please. We need you on the sidewalk. You can get on our mailing list for rally dates and times and addresses. This Friday, we'll be out in front of the fairgrounds promoting medical freedom. And Saturday, we will be in Pensacola during a Vax and Dash event at Community Health Northwest Florida, targeting our children. You can reach me by email, c4mf@protonmail.com. And also, real quick before I go, I would love to plug the fact that Panhandle Doctors for Truth are holding another medical freedom rally on November 9th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Blue Wahoo Stadium. Got another great lineup of doctors. The focus is going to be on women and children and the vaccine. So save the date. Please plan to attend and share with friends.
I already plan to attend that. I'll tell you more about that next week. All right, I got to let
awesome.
You go. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Citizen for Medical Freedom, and we'll do it again next week.
Awesome. Have a great week.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. This is part two of perhaps the most brilliant piece of founders' writing after the Declaration of Independence by Thomas Jefferson and The Crisis by Thomas Paine. And for this one, I have no idea who wrote it. I'm going to jump around a bit to get you caught up with Federalist Papers number 6 and the folly of the arguments of Publius, a.k.a. John Jay, and his preposterous assumption that the Constitution has to be ratified or the estates under the Articles of Confederation will break into 3 or 4 separate confederacies and the Union will be lost. The fact that no such evidence or circumstance for this exists is irrelevant to the elitists pushing the Constitution for their own personal gain and power. Pretty much what goes on today. So here is what Sentinel, pen name of the author of Anti-Federalist No. 6, said about John Jay's arguments. This hobgoblin appears to have sprung from the deranged brain of Publius, a New York writer who, mistaking sound for argument, has with Herculean labor accumulated myriads of unmeaning sentences and mechanically endeavored to force conviction by a torrent of misplaced words. He might have spared his readers the fatigue of wading through his long-winded disquisitions on the direful effects of the contentions of inimical states as totally inapplicable to the subject he was professedly treating. This writer has devoted much time and wasted more paper in combating chimeras of his own creation. That's how you insult someone, founder style. When it comes to explaining the reasons behind John Jay's arguments that the United States will descend into despotism and fracture, all from no evidence, logic, or reason for such events to suddenly take place if the Articles of Confederation remain in force, even though no such action or suggestion of such action had taken place under the Articles so far. Sentinel then says this: the source of the apprehensions of this so much dreaded anarchy would, upon investigation, be found to arise from the artful suggestions of designing men, and not from a rational probability grounded on the actual state of affairs. The least reflection is sufficient to detect the fallacy, to show that there is no one circumstance to justify the prediction of such an event. On the contrary, a short time will evince, to the utter dismay and confusion of the conspirators, that a perseverance in cramming down their scheme of power upon the freemen of this state, Pennsylvania, will inevitably produce an anarchy destructive of their darling domination, and may kindle a flame prejudicial to their safety. They should be cautious not to trespass too far on the forbearance of freemen when resting their dearest concerns, but prudently retreat from the gathering storm. The whole point to me of John Jay using false arguments for the Constitution are to generate fear, because people with fear can be led to places they would never go otherwise. Take a look at the entire response to COVID from government. Every bit of it is based on fear, on preposterous arguments of hiding and suppressing evidence of relief, and of making people do things they would never do using their own judgment and choice. Just like when considering the Constitution at our founding, fear is used to abandon completely the Articles of Confederation, where only minor amendments might have sufficed. Sentinel then says this: the other specter that has been raised to terrify and alarm the people out of their exercise of their judgment on this great occasion is the dread of our splitting into separate confederacies or republics that might become rival powers and consequently liable to mutual wars from the usual motives of contention. This is an event still more improbable than the foregoing. It is a presumption unwarranted either by the situation of affairs or the sentiments of the people. No disposition leading to it exists. The advocates of the new Constitution seem to view such a separation with horror, and its opponents are strenuously contending for a confederation that shall embrace all America under its comprehensive and salutary protection. Sentinel continues by considering John Jay's arguments of the necessity of the Constitution or else. I will admit that the necessary consequence of rejecting or delaying the establishment of the new Constitution would be the dissolution of the Union and the institution of even rival and inimical republics. Yet ought such an apprehension, if well-founded, to drive us into the fangs of despotism? Infinitely preferable would be the occasional wars to such an event. The former, although a severe scourge, is transient in its continuance, and in its operations partial, but a small proportion of the community are exposed to its greatest horrors, and yet fewer experience its greatest evils. The latter is permanent and universal misery, without remission or exception. As passing clouds obscure for a time the specter of the sun, so do wars interrupt the welfare of mankind. But despotism is a settled gloom that totally extinguishes happiness. Not a ray of comfort can penetrate to cheer the dejected mind. The goad of power with unabating rigor insists upon the utmost exaction. Like a merciless taskmaster, it is continually inflicting the lash and is never satiated with the feast of unfeeling domination or the most abject servility. My comment is that this brilliant expose of the fraud of the Federalists is the perfect precursor to the fraud of the deep state today. And as they try to resurrect the globalist cabal in control, which Trump actually challenged successfully, and they try to reduce our country to an everlasting gloom of work, taxes, and death, people all over the country are learning, just as the country did in the 1700s, that doom and gloom is not inevitable, and that a powerful, dominating elite is not in control because they say they are, and that nothing is preordained to get us there or keep us there. However, then as now, all that is necessary for powerful elites to run everything gather all the power to themselves, and to let them accumulate all the wealth and property for themselves is to believe their lies, do nothing, and then complain every step on the way down to tyranny that somebody should do something. Well, that somebody is you. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Of course, it'd be a lot better if I turned my microphone on. There we go. I've cut into Jonathan's report enough just because of timing, and I goofed. So I'm gonna we'll skip Jonathan's theme. We'll play it again next week because it's great, but it's almost 2 minutes long. Jonathan, we have a ton to talk about. We have all kinds of stuff. I got a big list of things. So whatever you want for the legal report today, let me know. Let me know where you want to go. Otherwise, I have, of course, tons of questions and issues and everything else that's happening. So for the folks that are new to this is where we talk constitutional law, legal things that are happening, court cases, anything of interest. Jonathan's a criminal defense attorney, constitutional expert, Second Amendment, expert, and knows a lot of really good stuff. There you go. There's your theme. Good morning, Jonathan.
That's great. Well, like you say, I don't know where I want to go either, not because we don't have things to talk about, but there's so many things going on. I feel yeah. You can hear me okay, right? I'm in a new location.
Oh, yeah, you're fine. Nope, it's good.
And I feel like a dog chasing his tail. There's just so much happening. And I had a whole bunch of things I was going to talk about last week, and then we got off on other tangents. So
let's catch up with that.
I'm sure
if we can. Yeah.
We'll be covered. But anyway, so one of the things that obviously is in the news, well, everything's in the news, and I do believe, let me just give a non-legal intro to some of this, is that I think the American people are not going back to sleep. Traditionally, what's happened, my mother was in legal forum from the late 70s with Phyllis Schlafly, and traditionally the American people will get disturbed and wake up and say no and then fall back to sleep again. So like the cartoons where the cat burglar is in the homeowner's house and someone's knocking it. So anyway, they're at the cat burglar, and then they start to wake up, and the cat burglar just waits until they go back to sleep again, and then continues to rob them. That has been the history of our country since World War II. And this time, I don't think that the American people are going back to sleep. And,
what changed? What do you think has caused this awakening to happen?
Well, I think a number of things. First of all, the left has gone so far so fast,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of like the American people have woken up after 50-100 year sleep and discovered their country is nothing like what they recognize, and so it's it's a completely different world, and the infiltration. The ability of the government to lie about who it is and what it's doing, when in reality the rot is going so deep that, when people start looking, they're shocked. And Trump had a lot to do with it's interesting, historians could get into a lot of discussions, but if they were honest. But it's different if it's sort of a combination between Trump as both cause and effect. If they talk about the great man idea of theory of history, and say Trump was both the result and the cause of further awakening, and the fact that the left is just so far out of touch, and they don't realize how far they are out of touch, and so when people actually look, it's so way out, and this is what's happening, of course, with the Virginia race. And if I can take, if everybody who prays could just really, really take a day, maybe even fast for Virginia, because mm-hmm. as they're saying, if the Democrats win Virginia under these circumstances, there is nothing we can win, the Republicans. I mean, because if this isn't bad enough, mm-hmm. what's happening in Virginia, then nothing is. The American
well, how
people
about the
are
vote
kind of
fraud?
Signaling.
Elections aren't determined by winners and campaign issues anymore. They're determined by vote fraud. Either it's allowed to happen or it's stopped. I mean, so vote fraud really is the determining factor. So how bad is the vote fraud in Virginia? Is it going to go ahead or is it going to be stopped?
Nobody knows, but because of because of what's happened, people are watching.
Okay.
You know, they are alerted to it in a way that they weren't before. So,
well, how are they watching?
Nobody knows.
Are the GOP geldings in every post office? Are they in the observation places? Have they scheduled? Are they at all the counting places? Are they watching all the mail people, the ballot boxes, the drop boxes? Are they watching the ballot harvesting? Are they they should have representatives just as they should have had in California. They should have representatives from all over the country, all over Virginia, watching everything they can.
Well,
that's what they need, and they're not doing that.
They should. And that's true, and that's part of the problem that
yeah.
what's wrong with the Republican Party. But there are people who are working on, cleaning up voter registration lists and
mm-hmm.
And canvassing. There's the Look Ahead America by Matt Brand,
mm-hmm.
Brainard, who is
Matt Brainard,
who organized
yeah.
He organized the political prisoners rally about those who are being locked up from January 6th and everything. Their group on the local level in Virginia has been working very extensively on this issue for months to try to make sure. So there is some hope, I think, that people are watching enough that it will be harder than you may fear for them to steal it the way they did before, because everybody's watching now. But we'll see.
Like in California, and there was a huge movement to recall Gavin Newsom, and he won quite handily, So I have no faith. Yes, California.
But I don't know that California is a good example, because they already were two to one. I mean, it would, to make a dent in California would, take the political equivalent of an atomic war with many nuclear bombs to make a dent on California. So I don't know if that's grounds for discouragement. But in Virginia, of course, you've got – and see, the thing is what we're hearing about the schools, that the schools don't want the parents involved. I mean, they'll say that – they'll talk about a stakeholder. When they say involved, they want them to show up and listen to a presentation on opening night and get a little certificate or something and then go home with a pat on their head and be quiet. The left has always said, I worked for 5 years at the U.S. Department of Education. And the attitude that's coming through now that's really kind of dominating the Virginia governor's race. And remember, there's a black woman running for lieutenant governor, Winsome Sears, and there's a Hispanic running as a Republican for for attorney general. And we're racist, because we have the Democrats attacked the black guy running for governor in California, and they've gone after Alan West, and but we're the racist somehow. I say sarcastically, obviously. So they've got the idea that they will give lip service to the importance of parents being involved, but really they shut them out. Is been there for. Since the 80s or more, but it's coming out now and people are seeing it, and it's really sort of dominating the race. We had Joe Biden come in to Northern Virginia two nights ago, which I think is mm-hmm. a net negative. McAuliffe's entire campaign.
The president actually things that happened with one hand. Campaign there. Hello? Where'd you go?
You're breaking.
Yeah. Okay, good. You're still there.
You're breaking up a little bit, but.
I'm breaking up a bit? Oh, okay. Gene, let's do a double check here because sometimes that happens because I heard you break up a little bit. Well,
yeah, you're okay, definitely, right. You were breaking up there.
Interesting. Okay.
So,
all right.
So the thing is that, I mean, Terry McAuliffe, the former head of the Democrat National Committee, Hillary
right.
Clinton, Flackey, Lackey, whatever, and once the former governor of Virginia, with all this massive, Rolodex and contacts and everything, he has been trying, his whole strategy is to tie Glenn Youngkin to Donald Trump. Now, Glenn Youngkin was the moderate, and a lot of conservatives in the Republican primary on May 8th believed that Youngkin was too squishy. But according to the Democrat campaign, Glenn Youngkin is like the illegitimate son of Pat Buchanan and, Senator McCarthy. Because they lie, as Chris Plant here says locally. He says they lie and they're not on our side. But so they're trying to they're spending this time trying to say that Glenn Youngkin, who was opposed in the primary because he was believed to be anti-Trump, that he's secretly the secret love child of Donald Trump. I'm kidding, but he's and I think that all the advertising from the Democrats is actually hurting them. Trying to say that Glenn Youngkin is Trump. It's not
that's
hurting.
That's
Glenn
a good thing
Youngkin
for him. Well, here's the thing. My perception of the Democrats is they hate Trump so much they think everybody hates Trump. And well, the problem is they're wrong because he's so overwhelmingly popular. I mean, those aren't Biden supporters at the rally. Those aren't Biden supporters in the streets, going against everything that's happening here. They're Trump supporters. And this idea that they say, well, he's just like Trump. And, of course, the people of Virginia are going, yeah, he is. That's great. So do they know they're doing this wrong? Are they so deluded with Trump derangement syndrome that they don't realize that Trump is amazingly popular with everybody outside of the extended D.C. suburbs in Virginia? Do they have any clue at all? I would say no.
I think they have always been clueless, and they have
okay.
always been everybody is like the crowd I hang out with syndrome. They've always been damaged by the idea because the left is herd, it's herd mentality. They are they are a herd. Their entire mentality is, basically they're so insecure they need to belong to the herd. Conservatives are so independent minded that we don't know how to work together. But
which presents other
they
problems.
Assume
yeah.
that being a member in good standing of the group means you must believe these things. And you must shout the loudest in the 2 minutes of hate from 1984, and that proves that you belong. You belong to the crowd. You belong to the club. And so they don't. I think that's why this is. I think January 6th was the equivalent of December 16th, 1773, which is the Boston Tea Party, and it didn't get any better from there.
Yeah.
And I want this to end peacefully, but the left is not going to stop. It's like in the American Revolution, there are so many times when the people in London, the king, the crown's administration in London, could have just been flippin' reasonable, but they just couldn't help themselves. They were so arrogant and they were so demanding that they put their foot in the pail over and over and over again. And I think the left is doing that here, is that we are in the head up to July 4, 1776. And I don't think there's anything on our side that can stop it. Because the American people are mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And the biggest thing is they realize the experts don't know what the heck they're talking about. And the government's lying to them and the media is lying to them. And if you put up a fact checker that we've never heard of, we don't believe it. We just don't believe it anymore. And so
that's
so
key,
why
though. that is so key that people don't believe it anymore. They know they're being lied to. Whereas before, in fact, Gene and Cindy were talking about this earlier, that, you know, it seemed reasonable to sort of, you know, shelter in place and stay home and take, you know, what appeared reasonable precautions. And I argued vociferously against that, saying that that was never, you know, something, but that was just me. But, you know, folks, and I'm sure Jean's position's changed over time. Cindy, who does a medical freedom report before you come on, her position's changed. Everybody is looking at this. People that didn't study the issue from, you know, years ago, just issues of freedom in general, and all of a sudden are coming to this. You know, Cindy's not a person, you know, who set about to, you know, run a group for, you know, Citizens for Medical Freedom, but she's done that because she sees what's going on. She sees what's happening to her friends, you know, the people she knows who are working in the, you know, the medical industry. And it's like, wait a minute, there's a big problem here. And so people are resisting and they're lining up outside hospitals and they're carrying signs, and Southwest pilots and Amtrak workers and all these different folks and truckers and, you know, government employees are saying, no, you know, this is the most encouraging. It's like a mass Boston Tea Party. I think that's a pretty good analogy. But January 6th wasn't the Tea Party. The Tea Party is now. This is when the Tea Party is going on. I think January 6th, I don't think people even thought of it as a protest. You know, they went to the capitals in support. They weren't protesting; they were supporting. That's part of the big lie. So here's a question for you, Evan. Go ahead.
I've been trying to do that because, you know, I'm representing one of the Proud Boys in the January 6th criminal prosecutions, and I'm just taking on another case, one of the others, and you know, they're trying to portray, and in the Congress, which I'd like to get to, they're getting into this big, like, actually, you're kind of giving me a great...
feel free. Great, run with it. Yeah, go ahead. Segue away.
Is that, you know, and I have to be careful not to quote, you know, attorney-client privileged conversations, so I'm trying to word this carefully, but mm-hmm. you know, what I'm hearing is that what you said is accurate. There wasn't a plan. It's not just that the plan, you know, because I'm trying to argue that the plan was different from what the government and the media and the political class are saying. And mm-hmm. and what the people I'm talking to are saying, not just that, but there really wasn't a plan. We didn't have a plan to go there. We just went there to make our voices heard.
Mm-hmm.
There was, like, they planned to obstruct the Electoral College certification.
No, they wanted to go forward. They wanted to go forward. Client, that's the crazy part, yeah.
My client, Zachary Real, is the head of the Proud Boys of Philadelphia. And they really are. It's, again, they're treating it like it's the Foreign Legion. Like, everybody, you know, somebody says it's jump and everybody says, so how high? I mean, the classic thing of the Proud Boys is that they say, okay, here's what we're going to do, and nobody pays any attention. They just do what they want to do anyway. Each city is really kind of independent. And but they accuse him. It's actually in the indictment. I mean, stop and think about, you know, the comical vision here. They say that Zachary Real stormed the Capitol with a radio and goggles. I mean,
so oh my God! Not the radio and goggles attack. Oh please, the assault radio.
I mean, that's the absurdity of this thing, And so, you know, so I'm trying to say, like, okay, if they were trying, because the charge of obstructing an official proceeding, which mm-hmm. originated from Arthur Anderson and the destruction of documents, mm-hmm. and maybe intimidating witness, it has nothing to do with this. And this is why all the defense attorneys are fighting about what does 18 U.S.C. 1512 mean, because it's never been used for anything like this before. But it carries a 20-year potential sentence. And that's one of the main reasons why these guys are still in jail, is because they're charged with these very serious crimes that don't really apply.
Well, they're political
prisoners. And so,
you know, I use that term for about 6 months now, and it's catching on. People are starting to use the same term. These are political prisoners. They're there because they support Trump, because it's necessary somehow to put a false narrative on the entire January 6th thing. And I'm going to ask you the reason why in a minute, but this is all about creating a false narrative. Because the real insurrection was the stopping of the electoral count, right?
I'm representing him also in the civil lawsuit police officers. Well, the police officers are being abused by the leftists. But they got physically beat on by some people on January 6th who are, you know, they should pay the price.
Right.
You know, about about 50, maybe 250 people battled with police out of 500,000 to 1 million. And But the thing is that so I'm trying to look and see, well, how would, because it's the biggest charge, it's the big, most serious charge, is how, what was the plan supposed to be to stop the Electoral College certification vote?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how, you know, you're gonna charge the Capitol with a radio? I mean, what exactly are you saying? You know, because they tend to be implying that there were all these people and they got inside the Capitol. There are people inside the building every single day.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, well, have you ever been, if you've been in the Capitol, other than members
there.
Of Congress and their staff, there's probably 1,000 people easily inside that 751-foot building at any given time during a work day. It's the size of a small ocean liner cruise ship. You know, I found a smaller cruise ship than the size of the Capitol building. So just having people in the building does not stop the Congress from meeting. Congress meets all the time with people milling around, school tours, you know, people in they're built into the chambers from the beginning are the galleries. The gallery is a huge, like in a movie theater or theater, it's this huge second level where there's no separation between the public sitting in the gallery. It's like a jury is open, like the trial is open in a courtroom. The people who sit and watch Congress in session, don't go in there and admire the architecture. They get to watch their representatives doing what they're doing. There's no physical separation between the people sitting in the gallery and the members of Congress in each house, because we're supposed to be able to watch the people stealing our stuff. And that doesn't stop Congress from meeting.
Yeah.
So how exactly is it that they were supposed to be stopping the joint session of Congress certifying the Electoral College votes? So just now what they're happening, of course, they're going completely crazy. In they're saying all these people are racist. What I found is that the Proud Boys website says
racist
all people
who?
Are welcome of all races.
Racist against who? Biden?
And it's that,
who are they racist against? Who are they racist against?
No,
the Proud Boys are. I'm confused.
The Proud Boys are racist and white supremacists just because the left says so.
Oh.
And even though their bylaws prohibit it.
Right.
If anybody is racist or what they call identitarian or ethnic nationalist, they're banned from the Proud Boys. I just put in things in the pleading showing how their bylaws and their website, you know, prohibit racism, but the political class just declares that they're white supremacists when it's absolutely no. You know, the head of the Proud Boys is a black immigrant from Cuba, and about 20% of the membership are minorities. But and this is where, you know, again, back to the thing that they're just lying to us, and we're not buying it anymore.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the House committee. Made up of, 12 Democrats, two of whom pretend to be Republicans. You know, Liz Cheney.
Liz Cheney, and, who's the other turncoat, rhino, squishy, gonadless, you know.
Yeah, right, I should know who that is. But so they're going after all of this stuff. And it's just come out recently that they are trying to, they've subpoenaed four leaders, including Steve Bannon. And I don't know if we went through this last time.
No, we didn't, but I'm curious about Steve Bannon because if I were Steve Bannon, I'd be at Congress because I'd be able to say anything I wanted in front of Congress. To me, that would be just fun. I'd love subpoenaed by Congress. Boy, would they get it.
Well, I'm with you. That's the way I would look at it. But but the thing is that – so
trips to Washington, food, yeah, let's go.
Just insult the hell out of them, yeah, because when they're used to people who are trying to get confirmed sucking up to them, it would be fun to like slap them around for. But the problem though is what they're doing is they're asking for what they start with private depositions and the public doesn't see it.
Right.
But still, so the thing is that they're trying to hold Bannon in contempt, and everybody, if you look at the comments on the Hill, for example, everybody is convinced that Bannon's going to go to jail. And the first thing, if I can squeeze in two big topics real quick.
Oh, sure.
Bannon is not going to jail because his lawyer has said that I will cooperate, but Trump has filed this lawsuit about the executive privilege, and I will abide by whatever the court decides. You literally cannot be in contempt if you're saying my position is I defer and I honor the courts, the same court that's going to supposedly throw him in jail. I am going to do whatever the court says. You're literally not in contempt, you know, because you know, see what I'm saying? It's impossible to be in contempt when you're saying that whatever the court wants to do, you know, I'm fine with that, but I'm going to wait for the court. I'm going to give the court the chance to make the decision. And because you can't put the courts love to say you can't unring a bell. Mm-hmm. So if he goes and testifies, he is, you know, ripping the authority out of the court. If the court is going to decide whether or not the executive privilege applies, and then he goes and he testifies before the court gets a chance to decide, then he's ripping the authority away from the court. And so, because you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So he's not going to go to jail. Now, the question is, does executive privilege apply? Yes. Executive privilege, and you know, I blame our public schools and our media. Executive privilege protects the ability of the institution of the president to get mm-hmm. advice. It's not to protect Donald Trump. It is not Joe Biden's to get, grant or deny. He does not have the authority, even though the massive stupidity in our Capitol is rampant, Biden does not have the authority to decide whether or not, you know, to waive executive privilege because it affects the institution, including future presidents. It does not belong to Biden. It does not belong to Trump. It belongs to the institution. And it goes back literally to George Washington. The executive privilege was invoked by George Washington, not as an exaggeration or a hyperbole or metaphor, literally. And it has been recognized at all times that if the executive cannot get candid advice, including contradictory advice, you know, let's go mm-hmm. around the room. And one guy says A, and the other guy says B, and someone else says P, and someone says R, and S and U. You know, if the president does not have the ability to get all kinds of different advice, even crazy advice, out thinking outside the box, then it cripples the institution. That is what exactly – and remember, when I was at Judicial Watch, I spent mm-hmm. a lot of time on this, researching it for Larry Klayman. It is – and there's also some a twin called the deliberative process privilege, which does not require the president to be involved. So does executive privilege apply to Steve Bannon, who was a private citizen? He was no longer – yes, because the president and his top advisors, it can be the president directly or indirectly, his circle of advisors, is getting advice. If President Biden were to go to Oklahoma and rent a room and get all these oil executives together and say, how can we, you know, solve the gas price thing? All private citizens giving him advice. You know, mm-hmm. in if it's in conference, it's on TV, it's not in conference. It's executive privilege, any privilege preserves the confidential nature. So if it isn't confidential to begin with, then you've lost the privilege. But if it's in confidence, the privilege maintains the confidence. So what the courts have literally said is that if advisors were hesitant to give advice because they see that it might be, you know, it might end up in the scandal sheets in the media, they would censor themselves and the presidency would be crippled because it would not get free and candid advice, including brainstorming, like I say. The advice that's given and protected does not have to be good advice. It might be terrible advice, but it's part of the brainstorming process. So that the courts have made very clear that this is absolutely necessary to the functioning of the presidency. Yeah. And of course,
it's the same reason diplomacy has to be done in secret. You know, and we got Claire on the line too. I'm going to keep her for a little bit. But yeah, diplomacy. There was something, I think it was during Wilson League of Nations, where they said that, you know, we have open diplomacy, open treaties, openly arrived at. It's a bunch of BS. You have to be free to explore ideas. You have to be able to risk being wrong. And I'll give you a more local example, a more recent one. Peter Navarro is the person I believe told Trump just to ride out COVID. Don't do anything. Don't do anything heroic, Herculean. Don't listen to Dr. Fascist. You know, he's a genocidal, psychopathic vaccine drug pusher. That's all he does, you know. And so if you just, most viruses are gone in 8 to 10 weeks. I've still got the COVID charts from the CDC, which had it starting, you know, early February and rising to a peak in April 15th. It's pretty much gone by July 4th. And then they started cooking the books and doing the numbers, and then the vaccines came out and brought it back. If that were commonly known, now I don't know, I'm just speculating, okay, just based on what he's been saying. But if everything had to be open and if there were no executive privilege, he would be immediately demonized. He would be, criticized every possible way, and he wasn't. But I still believe he was one that did that, and rightfully so. But because of executive privilege, you know, nobody knows exactly who said it unless Trump releases that information, which I wish it would. But I still think Peter Navarro and maybe a couple of others really said, don't do this. Don't go crazy. Don't follow Obama's, you know, pandemic playbook. This is going to be over soon. We already got the cures. You know, in fact, he has 60 million tablets of hydroxychloroquine ready to distribute nationally. That would have stopped this whole thing in about 3 weeks. Okay, so the information is there. Trump knows it. He's not going by it. He listened to the wrong people. But the thing is, Peter Navarro suffered no consequence, I believe, for presenting that information that he may not have wanted to present if he knew that everything he said to the president was suddenly open and that he'd be out there as the next victim of leftist, you know, character assassination. That's how I think it worked.
Right. But people don't understand, like, you know, the more people are in power and important in Washington, the less they know. You know, it's like people have joked that being elected, as soon as people are elected to Congress, they lose 50 IQ points. And I'm not, this goes back decades, people saying this.
Yeah.
And, you know, so nobody knows anything that they claim to, you know, about any of this stuff. Executive position privilege is not amnesty. So if somebody goes in and privately talks to the president and say, you really have to be tough, like, you know, I shot someone in a business dispute. Then he goes out on the street and says the exact same thing. Executive privilege does not protect him. People think that, you know, Bannon is going to, you know, other people are going to go to jail because of things like, or it shouldn't protect him because he's a private citizen. No, it protects the conversation. It doesn't mean, you know, if he goes out and, you know, and firebombs Nancy Pelosi's car, executive privilege is not going to protect him from that.
Right.
It's the conversation that is the privilege and and the advice. But so now they're going after, but see, the Congress, they've subpoenaed all these people. Three of the dummies, I mean, they may be good people, but they've gone ahead and testified, which they shouldn't have done. Now they're going after, I'll wrap up real quickly, but this is important. They want John Eastman, who is one of Trump's lawyers. Not real impressed by lawyers, as I've said. But he was the one. And they want to get Eastman to testify because he supposedly came up with the plan for January 6th to make Donald Trump president again in spite of the Electoral College mess. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, the memo, which I am a little bit disappointed, is not on letterhead. It's like what they call a white paper. I think that's cowardly. But his memo lays out how the Pence was supposed, and we've talked about it in general terms, but this is very specific and it's authoritative. So they want him to testify. Well, clearly this is attorney-client privilege. They can't do this.
Right.
But they're trying to get him to testify because he wrote the memo that Trump was following, which is fine. That has nothing to do with people beating on police or breaking windows. You know, if Trump wants to argue for why he thinks he should be reelected. That's, you know, they have no business investigating that, but that's why they want to bring it. But what's amazing to me is that this idea that the Proud Boys and all these other people wanted to stop the certification vote, the plan that John Eastman laid out requires Congress to be in session.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that is that the vice president would set aside the states, and not just as a dispute, but they say there are seven states that have sent two competing sets of electors. It's not just, I don't like it. It's not just Biden, you know, the vice president saying, I would prefer this candidate or that candidate. It's that I'm faced with two competing sets of electors. And people will say, well, you know, one was certified by the governor, but then you go back to the Constitution, it's the state legislature
right. That
is in control. It is not a state function. It is a federal function, choosing the president, delegated to the state legislature only. And so because they're performing a federal function to choose the next president. And so the plan was, I'm not saying it's a good plan or a bad plan or whatever, it was the plan that Trump was following at the war room at the the Willard Hotel. And the plan was is that Pence would set aside the seven disputed states because of this problem, and therefore Trump would have a majority of electoral college votes. So the point is that if the protesters had blocked the electoral college, the joint session from meeting, Trump's plan could not have happened. So in order for Trump's plan to succeed, whether it's a good plan or a dumb plan, it required Pence to cooperate and for the session to continue. There is no way that busting up the session could make Trump president for another 4 years. It's a stupid argument that all these demonstrators wanted to obstruct the certification vote. That how would that help anybody? We'd have no president at all. I mean, nobody is dumb enough to think that if you don't certify Biden, that Trump just continues for another 4 years. I mean, I don't think anybody was. I mean, maybe there's somebody that dumb, but I've never seen them.
But that's the false narrative, and this is what I want to get into with this here, because it is critical to understand that. Well, actually, there was an article you may have read it. If not, I'll send it to you. Sidney Powell wrote about how Nancy Pelosi canceled the continuation of the electoral challenge to the state specifically for that reason, and then had everybody, you know, after they got the talk, as I call it, you know, below the in the bowels of Congress, they all came up and voted. But so 12 senators. And 147, I think, representatives voted against the certification of the delegates to various states. So the challenge was there, but the challenge wasn't strong enough because of everything that happened. And so I believe that the insurrection was stopping that vote through the Republican geldings and, you know, Democrat Marxists who did what they could to stop it, that this was all part of it, and that the hearing going on now is a continuation of the insurrection, the oppression of these people, the political prisoners in the D.C. jail. All of this is about stopping, is about maintaining the insurrection. It's about maintaining the false, you know, presidency of Joe Biden. This is all part of it. They have to, and they're hell-bent on erasing the memory of Donald Trump and trying to destroy anybody who wants to, you know, even try this again or challenge it or even support Donald Trump. So they're going, this is a purge every bit. And I want to talk to Claire about this too, but this is like a totalitarian purge. They're arresting the people. They're making them political prisoners. They're holding false hearings for what's intended. The hearing is the insurrection. When they stop the vote in Congress January 6th, that is the insurrection, because the electoral challenge, the constitutional challenge, didn't go forward. Mike Pence is as big a traitor as anybody I've ever seen, because he had a couple of chances. In fact, we've had people on talking about that, where he had December, I think, 28th. He had January 6th. There were different times where Mike Pence, as president of the Senate, could have said, wait a minute. You know, we have contending electors. We have things that we need to sort out. This has to be settled before anybody is inaugurated, before anybody gets 270 votes declared and certified. So they never certified. See, that's the problem. And the question for you I want to get to before Claire is can you use that? Can, in defending the Proud Boys, in defending the clients you have, can you, through discovery, find out what Congress talked about? And did they talk about an insurrection? Oh. You know, below in the bowels of Congress, when there are people, you know, the Capitol Hill Invitational walking them, and I call it that for a reason. As Trump supporters are milling around upstairs going, hey, where's the certification vote? What's going on? You know, when they were talking in the bowels of Congress, can you use discovery to find out what they talked about and see if it was, in fact, part of the insurrection, and can you use that to defend your clients? That's my question.
Well, yes, but I have higher priorities because I've been plotting all day yesterday, and I'm going to be doing today how to use that John Eastman memo.
Okay.
To
show it to me,
that
or did you?
The prosecution, the government knows they were lying. I want to show that the government knew that the plan required the session to continue, and blaming these guys with obstructing a proceeding just because there's a 20-year sentence is prosecutorial misconduct, and I want to get the case thrown out. But it's going to be a multi-step process, and I'm going to draft some subpoenas. I was going to say something else, but I don't want to. The thing is that because the question is it may not impress the judge all that much, but the part of the question is what caused them to go into recess, because they're blaming it. If the defendants disrupted the session, then they may be guilty of a 20-year felony. If they were just there protesting, and the Congress said, "Yikes! Look at all the people we've ticked off. We probably should go hide." Mm-hmm. Then it's not my client's fault. So I am trying to use that hook to get into all that, but I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten, and I'm over time now. So.
And I got to play something real quick anyway for a minute. I want to. Next week, I guess we'll introduce this, or if Claire wants to talk about it too. Ray Epps, the FBI, provocateur that tried to get everybody to break into the Capitol building, has been outed by Revolver magazine. But let's get to that and other issues. I want to talk about China.
Let me say in 20 seconds, Ray Epps is huge, and we're going to be doing discovery into that.
Okay.
That is everybody in all of the defense attorneys are buzzing about that, and we're going to try to figure out how to go after that. But that is gigantic.
Yeah, there's another guy too, Stuart Rhodes. I'm starting to learn about these people too. So we're going to do more and more of this. I'll probably do a show next week on this. Anyway, let me play something real quick. We'll bring on Claire, and we'll talk about why I think China is always a good place to start. So we will be right back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can increase foot and website traffic. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. BESMALLBUSINESS. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything. Who says we don't have fun here? All right, let's bring Claire in the conversation. And if you have Claire Lopez, and if you have any comments on what Jonathan was talking about in terms of the ongoing insurrection, I'd be curious. And then, of course, we can always get on to foreign policy, intelligence, and everything that's been happening lately, which is a lot, too. Good morning, Claire.
Yeah, well, good morning. Good morning, Greg and Jonathan and everybody. I was listening for the last several minutes and found what Jonathan was saying fascinating. I would say, of course, we're not dealing with an insurrection. That's the wrong word. It's a coup. not an insurrection, but I really am fascinated by his last mention of that Revolver article. Apparently another one or more, excuse me, are due out soon. We've seen one article so far and more to follow, but with the revelations about Ray Epps, the former, or maybe present, current, number two in the Proud Boys, who obviously was acting as a federal provocateur in the day before and the day of January 6th at the Capitol. It is huge. It is huge, and excellent, excellent investigative journalism there by the Revolver people.
Yeah, they're a new source to me. I'm not as familiar with them. Do you know much about where they came from? Who's behind them? Do they have some good financial backing? Is there a good conservative fund or organization?
Don't know any of that. I know they've been around for quite a while. I've known about them for at least a couple of years, but more details about them, I just don't know.
Okay. Well, let's talk about federal provocateurs. I want to bring Jonathan back in here because I've heard about these folks. You know, when I was looking at the militia movement back during the Clinton administration, and I remember doing some research for articles on the militia of Montana, so I contacted them. And one of the things they told me was that you can always tell the FBI, you know, provocateur informant. They're the ones that want to blow things up. They're the ones that want to break the law. They're the ones that want to, you know, cut the barrel lengths of guns, you know, an inch short. You know, let's do this, let's do this. You know, they're trying to, I think it's called entrapment, where you actually end up causing a crime of people that wouldn't ordinarily do it. And so I'm curious about both your responses to this, but do you know how this is used? I guess it would be domestic. It's probably used, you know, in foreign spy operations as well. But the idea of provocateurs to purposely get people to break the laws so they can be prosecuted or persecuted or some way, you know, affected by other government policies or actions. Claire?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the very definition of the word provocateur or provocatsia for the Russian. To egg on and encourage and provoke people to do things they otherwise would not do under that encouragement to break the law and trap them thereby into criminal activity.
So
it was interesting, though, to me
watch
some of the video that was taken of Ray Epps on the night before, that is January 5, when he was outside the Capitol with people around and he was shouting, "Tomorrow, tomorrow, we have to go into the Capitol." I mean, why would you even say such a thing the night before, right?
When
nobody
it.
Knew what was going to be taking place the next day on the 6th. And immediately the people around him pushed back and said, "No, no, no." And one guy very loudly in front of the video, you know, close to the camera, began the chant, "Fed, Fed, Fed." They knew immediately that this guy was a provocateur. That was amazing, you know, video footage that we saw.
Everybody should take a look at it. I post a Revolver article, but this is definitely huge. But this makes sense, though, because if you're – and you're right with the word coup. And if you have an exact definition, I want to get to that, too, because I use the word coup all the time. I've been using insurrection because it sounds like administration, so I'm trying to be clever. But so I might not have been as accurate as I could have been. Jonathan, provocateurs.
Well, coup means a blow. Coup means a strike.
Oh.
A hard blow. And it carries the meaning of something sharp and immediately and quick, whereas insurrection sounds like something ongoing, long term, prolonged. But coup is something that unfolds rather rapidly. For example, what just happened in Sudan, for example.
Okay. Well, I want to get to that. I'm going to put Sudan in my list of things to talk about. But coup, I believe that the full term is coup d'état. It's a French word. And d'état means the
strike
state, right?
Strike against the state to bring down the state. It doesn't mean it has to happen in a single day, as it did in Khartoum. But it does mean that it is a sharp blow to bring down ruling government.
Okay. So it makes sense to me that if you were trying to bring down what was the lawful, you know, Trump electoral win, that in order to do that, you'd have to stop the electoral challenge, because if it goes through, then the fraud gets challenged. And if you want to do that, if you need people in the Capitol to stop that, you know, you would employ federal provocateurs to inspire the crowd to do things they wouldn't normally do, and then afterwards to cover that story, because lies beget lies beget lies. You know, once you start that, what's that, you know, oh, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive. You need lies to cover your lies, and every day you need a new set of lies. And the current lies are that this was an insurrection by these what are now political prisoners, but they need those lies. They need this commission to cover up the lies that stopped the electoral count in the first place. And this is how they're doing it. So this is the new lie. So this commission, which is a lie, which is part of the coup, which is continuing, you know, the narrative, so that people don't ask the real questions, which is, you know, these people should be in front of the congressional hearings themselves for being part of the coup that stopped the electoral challenge. And I'll send both of you the article by Sidney Powell, because it's fascinating that Nancy Pelosi had a lot to do with stopping that. And we still need to know what they talked about, you know, when they got the talk below the Capitol, when the Capitol invitational walk-in went upstairs. So, Jonathan, provocateurs, can you add to this an entrapment? I'd be curious.
Well, I really, you know, this is a case where I really think that the historical knowledge and what's happened, I mean, I know that people don't want to hear this and they have a hard time accepting it, but these things, as Claire has talked about, they really sound like a pattern. You know, these are techniques and practice things that they're importing from other, I mean, the fact that they could try them in a country once as strong and independent as the United States is sad. But these, you know, as Claire can talk about, these things are not new. What we're seeing, you know, to me, what little I know compared to Claire and, say, John Kwopitz is that, you know, people need to know that these tried and true techniques are nothing. They're not just happening here out of the blue. And I think, you know, I completely agree with what Claire said. The thing that struck me when I thought about it is this guy, probably Epps, the tall guy wearing an orange sweatsuit shirt, is he's not, maybe this part of the video, I don't know, I haven't seen, but he's saying nothing else but break the law. He's not saying we need to go in there and tell them this and we need to have our voices heard. The only thing he's focused on is cross the line to break the law, is go inside. Now,
so what's the penalty
say, well, maybe
that?
That's not breaking the law.
So what's the penalty, legal penalty?
Well, if he's government, he's going to be protected. As Norm Bradford says, though, however, the issue here is state of mind. Like Brad Guyer, one of the defense attorneys, keeps saying, most people have never been to Washington before. They come here, they're wide-eyed, they're looking around, they don't know how things, like, you know, is the Capitol normally open, but today it's closed? They don't know that. They're just, you know, basically like, you know, tourists who are mad at the government. And so these fine points,
that's
you know, somebody says, let's go in the Capitol. And like, they don't know what they're, but the state of mind, because all of these crimes, the big deal is what was their state of mind? Were they just going in the Capitol to take, you know, just because it's cool, or were they going in there to, you know, to kill Nancy Pelosi? And every crime, it depends on your guilty state. You have to be knowing and intentional. It's a state of mind. So, and the other thing is that, like Norm Bradford says, is that you can't conspire with the government. So if this guy is a government agent and they're trying to say, like, let's go in the Capitol, and says, yeah, let's go in the Capitol, says, no, it's invalid because you can't, you know, if he's a government provocateur, then he is, you know, then there's no conspiracy. Yes, they may have gone in the Capitol. Yes, they might be guilty of trespassing. My guy might be guilty of smoking a cigarette in a federal building, but they're not. It's not a conspiracy. So I'm glad to hear. I mean, it's really, Claire's right on all that. But like I say, you know, if you want to know, you know, it's like the tsunami coming. If you want to know the tsunami behind the little wave we're seeing, Claire and the people who know what's happened in other countries, you know, we need to take warning from that.
So, Claire, did we teach other countries to do this? Did they teach us to do this? Both? Are they trying it here when they haven't tried it here before?
No, we're not teaching other countries to do this. This happens, unfortunately, on a rather regular basis in very many places. Okay. You know, I just mentioned Khartoum
in
the last couple of days. And other places have gone through upheavals like this. But it does call to mind what happened in Russia in 1917, and I think that's where a lot of what's going on in America right now comes from. Lenin and the Bolsheviks, the majority faction of the political party to which Lenin belonged, conquered the entire country of Russia with, I don't know if, I mean, maybe my numbers are off, but 100 million people, maybe,
yeah,
in 1917, did that with about 2,000 people. 2,000.
Yeah.
That's what it took to overthrow, you know, the government of Russia. But those practices, those the strategies, the tactics used in that overthrow, and then subsequently going forward by Russians, by the KGB, well, and all of its predecessors, Chekhov and NKVD and all the rest, in other places. For example, in Eastern Europe, which they, you know, brought under Soviet domination for so many years, the tactics and the strategies they used definitely were imported into other places, and perhaps here. Certainly, the Democrat Party is full of, literally, of communists. Trevor Loudon goes into this in great detail. Take a look at his Counterpunch video series at Epoch Times to find out more. But the Democratic
Party... Yeah, he's been on the show, too.
Dominated by the Democratic Socialists of America, that's communist. So
yeah,
those tactics, the infiltration, the co-option, the provocatia, the, you know, these kinds of tactics to overthrow legitimate governance, I say they came out of communist Russia.
Well, this would be fascinating. I don't know if you're prepared for this, but if you could just really quickly go over the steps. I mean, where did, like, what five things that they did that allowed 2,000 people to rule over 100 million?
Well, there was discontent to begin with, all right? So in those days of early 20th century,
right,
there really were very, very many poor proletariat worker people. And a very small sliver of elites at the top. And, of course, that was headed up by then the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas II, and his family, and those elites who benefited from the Tsarist system. Okay, yes. And yes, the Tsar himself had secret police. Of course he did. And there was repression. And there was a great economic divide and tremendous discontent and unhappiness among the masses, if you will, the proletariat. So you begin to take advantage of that discontent, of that unhappiness, not to improve things or make things better, which would, you know, dissolve the discontent or ameliorate it in any case. You don't seek to make things better. You seek, as Saul Alinsky wrote in Rules for Radicals, you seek to exacerbate the discontent, the unhappiness, the dividing lines between people, between their classes here in the United States, its races.
Right.
You carve out identity zones among the population and get people to retreat into tribal factions. That's the definition of provocatia. That's what you do. And then, of course, you know, false rumors and false flag events and staging events yourself that are then, you know, attributed to others to place blame and further exacerbate the situation. That's how you do it. That's what's being done here.
Okay. It's fascinating that the things that came to mind were things that you've talked about before. You know, you take over the education system. You put the ministers in place so that the bureaucrats will follow, and they'll willingly follow the new regime because that's what bureaucrats do. You know, they want to keep their power too. And then you'd have something like, if you wanted to have a show trial. You'd have what Kafka, you know, talked about in the trial. You have these, you know, you're guilty of being charged, you know, charged with what? Well, it doesn't matter, you know, you're guilty, you know. And I forgot exactly the plot of it. Basically, it was a never-ending, well, I'm sure Jonathan studied that in law school or before it. But the idea of these show trials, these star chambers, these things that Stalin or Lenin said, everybody's guilty of something, you know, we've got enough laws. We'll find the law that you've broken. And so then it would make sense that this what I call, you know, the coup investigation that's being held is really part of the coup. that is part of the cover, that you would have show trials, that you would have these, these, you know, big meeting, you know, hearings and make it very public. We're doing this for you. We're going to solve the problem. But the people solving the problem are the problem.
Yeah, you're exactly right. This is nothing more than an imitation of the old style Stalinist show trials. That's exactly what this is.
Okay. Jonathan, what do you think? Do you ever get to, through the Kafka's book? I mean, I read it years ago. I've forgotten some of the basics, but you know what I'm talking about with show trials.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't know if I can do better than what Claire is explaining, but I mean, it's a sad, ugly part of pretending that the judiciary is something real. I mean, I can't get out of my head the judge from the Third Reich, who would just get up there and yell at accused conspirators. I mean, it was a court that has the, like everything in the Nazi third regime, had the appearance of, you know, had appearances of I want to say of legitimacy from times past. But all the judge did was just get up and yell at people. I mean, there was nothing remotely judicial about it.
Yeah,
it's just stunning. And so, the show trial, corrupting and co-opting, you know, things that we want to admire and using them for purely perverse political purposes is a sad history. And we have to, and, you know, it's happening because, again, we have to remember that we're dealing with a couple hundred people who have spent the last 30, 40 years being indoctrinated in the schools that we're just now waking up to how bad they really are.
Yeah. Do you think that technology has made a difference? You know, it would be easier in Lenin's Russia and Hitler's Germany because they controlled the information so much more. They didn't have a revolver, you know, outing, you know, Ray Epps. They didn't have some of the things we have today. And as much as big tech wants to censor, they can't censor everything. As much as the government wants to condemn and demonize and the left wants to dox and show up outside your door, the information is still getting out. And I think that's a huge advantage for us to sort of turn this around that didn't exist 30, 40 years ago when governments were doing the same thing, but they didn't have the opposition who could organize around the information. Claire, does that make sense?
You know, that works both ways. And there's a battle royale going on right now precisely in that battle space, the battle space of information. and it's not certain yet, you know, which side will win. But the basis of all this that we can say, of course, is that modern technology has turbocharged the ability to message for whatever purpose, for good or for ill. And unfortunately, in the United States, over the last decades, the forces of ill, communists, Marxists, have gained control of a lot, you know, of our media, as well as other institutions like academia.
I think that's, obviously that has to be turned around, but that's going to be a big fight. I actually have a bill that I wrote, amending Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which takes away all the power of big tech to remove what they consider objectionable or otherwise objectionable material by simply stating that all the powers they have to remove objectionable material are already covered by obscenity, pornography, and especially child pornography laws. So there's no reason to make something illegal twice. So you can maintain a separation between the providers and the users of what they call interactive computer services, you know, which is search engines and social media. We can do that, and the bill that are very simply says that the providers will maintain their liability from what the users post so long as the providers don't touch what the users post. It's a very simple thing, and I use the words wall of separation in the bill. But that, to me, is the answer, and, you know, the bill's out there. I hope to get it, you know, as the show grows massively, which we got some things in the works. But as that happens, you know, we hope to have more and more impact and impact the national debate. But that, to me, is the most logical solution. It's not antitrust. It's not a bunch of regulation, because Facebook already has fake whistleblowers before Congress to guide that regulation. Most companies, big companies, love regulation. They thrive on regulation because it allows them to dump their competition. So that's not the answer. But I think there are answers. We just have to get, like I say, our bill, our Section 230 amendments out there. Jonathan has read them. You know, Congressman Matt Gaetz has them. He says he has all our legislation, our federal legislation. He hasn't acted on any of it yet. But it's there. It's there if we could ever move it. Jonathan, you know that bill I'm talking about, right?
Wait,
I'm back on here. If you don't, that's okay. My amendments,
Greg, I mean, I'll jump in and I'll just say that I think that's exactly the kind of revision that needs to be made to Section 230. Don't know why there aren't many members of Congress already proposing such a bill themselves,
mm-hmm.
and at least championing it, even if it's not making headway in a Democrat-controlled legislature. I've heard congressional members talking about exactly what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
but have they not themselves put forward such a bill in committee anyway?
I have. I'll send it to you.
Yeah,
and
I know, but
we
got
to
have this inside of Congress. It can't be outside. It has to be inside.
No,
but
absolutely.
Haven't they, Matt Gaetz, for example? No?
No, he's more concerned with hair gel and a media star. He used to be concerned because we wrote a bill back in 2018, right before I got fired from WBY for, you know, not following the format, but that's another story. But I wrote a bill on the air with eight callers, creating eight paragraphs of the bill. I actually typed it up as the show was going on, mandating the citizenship question on the census. And in fact, I played this last Friday, the interview I had with Matt Gaetz, the last one where he called the show, and he talked about his support for it, how it went to Congress. I think it went to the Freedom Coalition. I know it went to the White House. And it looks like, you know, part of it ended up in the president's executive order, President Trump's order, which, of course, was overturned later by the Supreme Court unjustly. But that's the kind of impact we used to be able to have when these folks were calling. And we have a series of press releases that have issued that are coming out with these bills, with these things. So we're trying to reach out as much as possible. But it really counts on people, you know, who know people to share the bills, to say, look, here's the idea. It's already done. I've got the section. I've got the quote. I've got the rationale for it. I've got the old law. I've got the new law. It's ready for a committee hearing right now. This is what we do here. You know, this is why it's so frustrating to me to not get this stuff up.
But this is what they're supposed to be doing there already.
But they're not.
Surprised that they haven't. Because there's been a lot of discussion about that Section 230.
Yeah.
There've got to be bills in written form to
one
be proposed in committee. There have to be.
Well, there aren't, as far as I know, because they're talking about antitrust and they're talking about regulation, which two of which are not needed. I'm going to send you the bill right now. And so what I want to do is, something I'm trying to talk and to do, you know, stuff at the same time. So let me get it to you and both of you again so that you can, you know, help share this out there. But this is what needs to happen. In the time we have left, I want to cover a couple of foreign policy things. You mentioned Sudan. What's going on there and how does that affect us? And then I want to do a little China chat. Sort of an update there.
Well, as we know, the former Sudan split into two a few years ago, northern Sudan with the capital at Khartoum, southern Sudan with the capital at Juba.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about right here is northern Sudan and Khartoum. And a few days ago, the military deposed the prime minister, put him under house arrest, and took over the government. Some of what I've heard about why they did it, and I'm not completely sure yet. Things are quite confused still over there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the reasons apparently had to do with the military's perception that the ruling regime in Khartoum was too close to the Muslim Brotherhood. And as we all know,
we've heard that before.
For the decades that the former ruler of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, ran the country, that was a Muslim Brotherhood regime in close cooperation for many, many years with the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan, Hassan al-Turabi. And, of course, it was under their leadership that Omar al-Bashir, in the year 1990 and going forward, convened in Khartoum meetings of all the jihadis of the world that brought together the Sunnis and the Shiites, the incipient then just forming Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, together with the Iranian regime and Hezbollah, brought them together in Khartoum, and that was the beginning of the planning for 9/11. That was a Muslim Brotherhood regime. The concern that I've heard now is that the military is afraid that those Muslim Brotherhood influences are still alive and well inside of Sudan and were gaining power within the ruling government, and that is why they deposed it. Cannot be certain of all of those details because it's a very fluid, confusing situation, but that's what I've heard.
That is fascinating. And this is the same Muslim Brotherhood that Obama loved, that was brought into the White House, the same Muslim Brotherhood of Robert Morsi in Egypt, the same Muslim Brotherhood cooperating with Iran. This is also the same group, right? Same leaders, same?
There's only one Muslim Brotherhood, yes. It's worldwide. Okay. It's global. It's in America. It's in Sudan. It's in many, many places. Has a lot of front groups in the United States, of course. CARE, ISNA, ICNA, MPAC, MAS, all of the above.
CARE would be the, if I remember, the Council on Arab something.
Council on American Islamic Relations.
Okay,
it is the U.S. branch of Hamas. Hamas itself, the Gaza branch of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood.
Okay.
And Hamas, of course, figuring on the U.S. State Department's foreign terrorist organizations list.
But not when it's CARE. And CARE
no,
is such
CARE
a nice
is
name.
Not a terrorist organization because it doesn't commit terrorism, and you cannot go vertically up and down the org chart and ascribe to the parent or the offshoot the crimes of the entity. It doesn't work that way. The entity itself has to be guilty of violence against noncombatants to land on the foreign terrorist organizations list. Violence or threat of violence against noncombatants against Americans, American national security interests. And CARE doesn't do that. The Muslim Brotherhood doesn't do that, so they can't be on the list. But nevertheless, that's who these people are, and that's who their affiliations are with.
Right. So CARE is like the nice, friendly, you know, neighborhood
They're the
Muslim association.
The subversive branch of the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas in America.
Interesting.
Along with all the others that I just named. I mean, ISNA, Society of North America, Islamic Circle of North America, Muslim Public Affairs Council, Muslim American Society Center, et cetera, et cetera.
Did they get money from us? Are they considered NGOs?
No. They get lots of money from lots of places, but not U.S. government taxpayer money. But the U.S. government does collaborate with them. I mean, the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security regularly meet with and collaborate with CARE representatives and other Muslim Brotherhood front group leadership.
Why? excuse my ignorance. Why would they do that?
Because they've been penetrated and co-opted.
Okay. Makes sense. We should talk more about that. I think that's a whole, you know, show in itself, the penetration of our government by all these things, by the Marxists, by the – well, there's almost like a – I think you've said talked about this before, sort of a Marxist-Muslim, you know, cabal.
Red, black, green axis, as some of us call it.
Okay, so red would be communist, black would
red
be...
Red is communist, Marxist, black Lives Matter movement, which is both communist, and, Marxist, and Maoist, and green, of course, the Islamic movement, which is their term for themselves, by the way. I didn't make that up. Islamic movement is what they call themselves.
Red, black, green. I have a look at it. This is fascinating. Well, I'll be doing more with this, obviously. I want to get on China a little bit. We've got about 12 minutes left. China, we've got hypersonic missiles going off. We've got overflights of Taiwan. We've got new islands being set up. We've got incredible arrogance. And we've got, you know, China's ambassador to the United States, Joe Biden, who's just sitting there. And I guess the theory is China's – I think you said this in your video recently, that we've got the Olympics coming up. So China's not going to do anything now. But after that, who knows what the hell they're going to do. How do you see that?
Well, I mean, obviously the expressions of contempt – arrogance by Chinese diplomats and other leadership aimed at American leadership are rampant. We perhaps saw the first or one of the most earliest egregious examples of that in the earlier in 2021 meeting in Anchorage, Alaska between Secretary of State Antony Blinken, National Security Advisor Sullivan with Chinese counterparts. Just absolute in-your-face contempt when they sit there and took it like little schoolboys. But that is increasing, as are the militarily hostile activities that you've just mentioned there, Greg, overflights of Taiwanese airspace, the testing of actually it was a test not of a hypersonic cruise missile, but rather of a hypersonic glide vehicle, many of the same characteristics and abilities of a hypersonic cruise missile. So, you know, a difference without a distinction or a distinction without a difference. But hypersonic glide vehicle was what was tested with capabilities that I don't know why they would have broadcast this, but the U.S. intelligence community immediately piped up and said, oh, we're taken by so surprised. We had no idea they were doing this. I don't believe that for a second, by the way.
Right.
But that they
that, yeah.
also admit that we have no counter defense against such missiles or HEVs at the moment. I'm not sure about that, if that's true or not.
Yeah.
But anyway, what the reason for all of this, the reason for the uptick, the reason for the increase in all of this is that the Chinese regime, the Communist Party of China, just like regimes elsewhere around the world, have taken the measure of the current administration and found it weak and incapable of leadership. I mean, even our allies and friends in Europe and in NATO are flummoxed. They don't know what to do with this administration. They don't know what to do with this White House. You know, they may have had their differences with Donald Trump, and certainly they did, but they knew what they were getting. They knew what they were dealing with, and they recognized and respected the leadership, the forthright, authoritative leadership of Donald Trump. But with this one, they really feel adrift. That is our allies and friends, while our adversaries and enemies are rubbing their hands in glee because they know that they could trample all over this White House.
Yeah. Is there any talk that you're hearing from our allies that are saying exactly that you idiot?
Yes.
You know, I call this the
morning,
government stealing the government. You know, the government actually stole
morning,
the government. Yeah, go ahead.
I just read a very good piece, and I forget where it was published exactly, but you can look it up. It's by Conrad Black.
Oh, I know him.
A very astute commentator. And he wrote a piece that I read this morning, which was talking about exactly this, the confusion among our European allies and NATO allies about how to deal with a White House that's, I mean, not his words, my words, made of limp spaghetti. They don't know what to do with it.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
They knew perfectly well how to deal with a Donald Trump. Whom, you know, what you see is what you get. We may argue, we may disagree, but we're allies. We know that you stand with us, Donald Trump, you know, we'll work out our differences. But with this one, they, according to the Conrad Black article, and I'm sorry I don't remember where it was published.
No,
but,
we can find it.
Very recent.
I'll post it. Yeah.
They don't know what to do with a Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Or his staff, his people.
Well, and this is the thing I wonder if they understand or look at the same way, you know, all of us who are on the show do, that, and I call this the government stole the government. You know, Trump was elected by the people. Biden was, you know, stolen by the government. And so to do this, you know, you would think that they would steal the government for at least a somewhat decent purpose. What they've done is that they've proved that when the government steals the government, everything goes wrong. And I talked about the supply chain earlier. I was going to get into that this time. Maybe we can do it next time. I got a great article by, I think it's St. Ange. I forgot his first name. But it's in Daily Signal. It's on my page. I'll share it with you guys. But talking about all the complex things that are going wrong, from the truckers to the people being paid off to not work, to the unions, to the environmentalists. It's just this whole – it's
yeah,
all
–
none of this
Greg,
was necessary.
Greg,
yeah.
According to the team that has taken the White House,
right,
this is not going wrong. This is
yeah.
exactly what they want to happen. When you understand – I think I've said this before – when you understand that these are people who believe that America is a force for ill in the world and that the only solution is to take America down in order to better the overall globalist world, then everything they're doing has a moral imperative to it in their little brains and minds. They think what they're doing is morally and ethically right to destroy America. So open borders, crashing economy, plugged up supply system, craven capitulation before our adversaries and enemies. This is not a failure for them. This is what they want to happen. This is the agenda. You see what I'm saying?
No, I do say it, and I agree with you. And I've said, you know, similar things, you know, that this is, when we talk about the fact that 100,000 Afghani, you know, goat herders and their five-year-old wives, as I call them, you know, were brought here when 400-some Americans are still back there. I know that's by design, to bring Afghanis here, to bring, you know, to increase the Muslim population. I know that when all those weapons were left was to basically build up the Taliban. You know, I see these things as all being purposeful as opposed to being, you know, incompetent. So I agree with you, absolutely. What I was questioning was, you know, what our allies are looking at when they see that this that our government was stolen and this is what they're doing with it. They have to be scratching their heads and say, you idiots.
Well, they're
is,
very
without America, hearted. Without yeah. America, where are they?
I mean,
go ahead.
Even when they disagree, this mm-hmm. disheartens them. This okay. is appalling and just, well, disheartening to them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if America is the leader of the free world. Oh, go ahead, Jonathan. Yeah, let me get you in here. Jonathan.
Well, I just want to real quick about what Claire was saying. I think mm-hmm. we also need to remember that it's almost instinctive or subconscious. When everybody's been indoctrinated the same way, it's like they don't have to explicitly talk about, you know, let's all take America down or any of the other things they do. It's, they've been indoctrinated, you know, they've been steeped in it from, you know, from elementary school. And they just do it without even thinking, I think, that like, of course you need to oppose any strength, the police, the military, America's place in the world.
You know, it's interesting that the communists in Russia used communism to build up their country in a huge industrial base. I mean, they did it with tyranny, but they grew from it. China, you know, Mao built up a huge military and, you know, and used communism for that. Communists here are using communism to destroy our country. It's like almost the opposite. They're using the tyranny
to
destroy
us. To merge us into global Marxism.
Okay.
We are to be part of that Soviet CCP whole. It's breaking America. Traditional America, America of the Founding Fathers, America the Republic down, but in order to bring our capabilities, our assets into the global Marxist communist movement,
mm-hmm.
to be part of that.
I think part of that's stealing elections so that they don't have to worry about, you know, Trump or people that actually believe in America. Both of you, and Gene too, feel free to jump in here. 2022 elections, is there any reason to believe they won't be stolen also as part of the Marxist plan? Claire?
Oh, yeah, lots of reason. Because people are awake now, anywhere from the common ordinary American citizen patriot all the way on up to state legislatures and governors. Awake in a way, knowledgeable in a way, observant in a way that just was not even on the horizon back in November of last year, 2020. They are enacting measures, recruiting people to be poll watchers, you know, election officials, on a massive scale, getting out messaging that was nowhere to be found last year. It's going to be a very different voting year in 2022 than 2020, yes.
Do you think we can outvote the vote fraud?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, that's encouraging. Jonathan?
Well, I mean, yes, but of course it depends. Like, Virginia is neck and neck, which is ridiculous. It should be, you know, McCollum.
Is it neck and neck, or is that propaganda?
Right now, but
is
when
it
it's
neck
really
and neck?
Close.
I'm sorry.
What?
Well, is it neck and neck, or is that just propaganda?
It's really close. It's hard to say.
Okay. You're breaking up a bit. Try again.
Oh, okay. I'm saying when, like, Virginia is so neck and neck that there may be enough. It may be close enough that they can cause mischief. But I do believe that people are watching to a much greater degree. So we need to win by massive amounts. Everyone needs to be praying for Virginia because it is going to. If the Democrats win Virginia, they're going to go wild all over the country. If we win Virginia, they're going to, you know, the moderate, the non, well, the less crazy people in the Democrats are going to climb on the brakes.
We got 90 seconds left. Claire, Virginia, what do you think?
I think it is very close. I think that Glenn Youngkin, the Republican candidate, has a very good chance of pulling it out. Everything really depends on getting the vote out, and that will be this coming Tuesday, November the 3rd.
Well, they've been voting. You've been voting for a month now, haven't you? You Virginia.
There has been early voting. Yes, there has been, okay. And I've seen lines in places with early voting. People standing, or cars, I should say, basically. Well, people too, lined up. You know, waiting to do early voting. I don't think we should have early voting. I understand the purpose of absentee voting. When you're a diplomat serving abroad, military, you need to have absentee voting. You're an invalid. You can't get out of your house, okay? But other than that, I agree with, I think it's Marjorie Taylor Greene who says, you know, one vote, one day, one person, on paper, no machines.
Yeah, yeah. I would also add to that our bill in Florida to end, to have voter registration expire every year so that everybody re-registers. That way the dead people can't stay on the rolls for 15 years. We got 20 seconds left. Jean,
no,
the last word here.
It's encouraging to hear that. Yeah, you think that people are going to be paying more attention and there won't be as much voter fraud. But all I can say is, people in Virginia, please get out and vote.
Yeah, outvote the vote fraud. I've been saying that since 2018. Claire, Jonathan, Jean, thank you so much. And earlier, folks, Cindy, and anybody else, you know, listening in, do what you can. And let's talk tomorrow, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, 6 o'clock Central. What is it? 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific, and we'll do this again tomorrow. Thank you all very much. This was a fascinating show, as always.
Have a great day.
Thursdays for the things that we talk about. It's wonderful. All right, blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.